She's on the appeal when he gets back. I'm assuming she's just out.
He's got a timeshare in Hawaii, I think he's got.
Everyone, I'd like to convene the November 17th, 2015 meeting of the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. With that, I think we have a very interesting agenda this afternoon. We're going to have informational meetings on the fire season, on the coastal multi-species conservation plan, and also an introduction from the newly formed Oregon Mining Association. So, thank you everyone for being here, I'm going to open an informational meeting on the fire season. The first panel, I'd like to welcome, please, State Forester Doug Decker and Doug Graff. And gentlemen, if there's anyone else that you wanted to bring with you, please feel free.
Hey, Kelly.
Hey, thank you.
Carl just walked in.
Thanks for getting that fixed.
He's on the hatch box program.
Where is he?
He's right there.
Let's see if he wants to see
it. Yeah, please. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Witt, Vice Chairs Krieger and McLean, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm joined this afternoon by several ODF leaders to complete the conversation that we started collectively. We started here with you on September 28th.
Yes.
About forests and about fire, and to weave together several important aspects of the fire of the 2015 fire season and our fire business in the future, which we're thinking a lot about today. Mr. Graff and I have a 3 o'clock appointment next door, and so we will we may excuse ourselves.
Yes.
To be timely there.
Yes.
Our colleagues Lena Tucker and Chad Davis will be here, and we know that you have other items on your agenda, so we'll do our best to manage our time carefully. I think when we were last before you, there was a landowner panel that was before you, and in September, and they talked about the costs and the loss associated with the 2015 fire season, and I want to just recognize that. We've had a chance, Doug and I have been before a couple committees this morning talking about the 2015 fire season, and each time we recognize the loss associated, not just the cost of fighting fire, but the loss for the landowners. Yes. And the additional workload associated with damaged resource. We also recognize the impact to communities that are tied close to our wildlands, and I'll emphasize, and you'll see in Doug's comments, that you know this was the third really hard fire season in a row. So thanks to many of you had some of you out on the fire line and in fire camp this summer, appreciated that, and in summers past, and we know that you were I appreciated your notes, got a number of notes of support and appreciation for our fire briefings as we worked our way through fire season, and that means a lot to me and to my folks. I appreciated those that level of support. Just for background, the Department of Forestry, your state agency, we provide fire protection on 16 million acres of Oregon's forest. That's about half of all of Oregon's forests. All state-owned forest land, all private forest land, and then we also protect Bureau of Land Management land in western Oregon, what you've often heard referred to as the checkerboard. So by statute and by reputation, I think the Department of Forestry is known for aggressively fighting fire, safely fighting fire, and we control the vast majority of fires of less than 10 acres. You don't hear about them, and we're proud of that. Some do escape initial attack, particularly during challenging burning conditions or when we get a lot of lightning. But our job is pretty straightforward. It's to put the fire out, and we do that. We work closely with private landowners, with contractors, with our federal partners, and our local cooperators in what we call the complete and coordinated system. You'll hear us refer to that, which means that we share firefighting resources within Oregon as well as outside the region as well. We had firefighters here from 35 different states this last fire season, 2015, and we have sent folks accordingly as well. So when fire threatens buildings and communities, we work very closely with the State Fire Marshal's Office and other structural fire protection partners. This year, we also had the opportunity to work with the Oregon National Guard, and both on the ground, with boots on the ground, first time since 2008 that we've 2002, since first time since 2002 that we've mobilized the Guard on the ground and also in the air with helicopters. We've done that repeatedly. So maybe one other last bit of background about the department's fire business I want to touch on is that we operate in what we call the fire militia. And what that means, that's our model, and what that means is that everybody in the agency has a role, whether you're in the state forest program or the forest practices program, or if you're in our administrative division, when the fire bell goes off, you are expected to have a role fighting fire. And that works really well because it allows us to maintain a high level of expertise at a very reasonable cost, and it kind of defines our culture as an agency of a get-it-done organization. But it also means that during high fire activity, there's a lot of other things that don't get done as we shift our focus into our fire business. And these last 3 years have presented an extraordinary workload. And so the fire militia that we have works really well. 1 year works pretty well, 2 years, and it's been 3 years in a row now. And, you know, I am concerned about the overall sustainability of the militia model and our organization, and that creates questions and issues for us going forward that I think Doug Graff will talk on in a moment. So our lineup here, Fire Chief Graff will walk us through the highlights from the 2015 fire season. Our Deputy Chief of Private Forest, Lena Tucker, is here, and Lena's been working very closely with private landowners, particularly on the east side, to help pick up the pieces after fire. And I thought it would be helpful for you to hear that. You heard from the landowner panel, and we want to talk about some of the challenges and opportunities that we have encountered picking up the pieces after big fires, and Lena can tell you about that. And then Chad Davis, who's behind us here, Chad's the leader of our Federal Forest Health program, who you've heard from before, I think, in this committee. He's going to bring you up to speed on how the state is helping to improve the fire resilience and overall forest health of our federal estate, the federal ownership, and the communities that depend upon on our federal forests. So we will welcome questions and comments along the way, and I'll apologize in advance for having to leave about 2:55, and we'll lateral it to Doug to encapsulate the 15 fire season.
Okay, good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Doug Graff, Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry. And in 10 minutes or less, I will touch the highlights, and I hesitate with that word. It's potentially the lowlights here, you know, the challenges that we've had with fire season. We've all lived that. Looking across the table here, many faces seen on the fires this summer. But I do want to leave some key messages for you, ensure that you have the latest statistics on numbers of acres burned and cost, and you have a sense of where we ended up for the fire season. So that'll be my focus. From the beginning, as we entered into 2015 fire season, we look at our fire risk analysis, and looking at the map here, you can see the red bullseye across Oregon, the entire state of Oregon. Not a good sign as we enter into 2015 fire season. Compared to 2014 fire season for the months of July and August, we know what 14 fire season looked like. 13 fire season, again, significant challenges. So when we see the risk maps, this is an analysis done on predicted weather, current conditions across the landscape. This is a national look from the National Interagency Fire Center. This map, it was disconcerting to us, but we knew this was coming to some degree, driven by the drought that I'll get to. But I don't know that I recall a map looking like this for July and August across the full state of Oregon for the extreme risk of fire conditions. And that's exactly what played out, as we all know, in the state of Oregon. I might highlight also the trend to the east and then just the overall fire risk in the west. That played out in different ways than it had in 13 and 14 fire season when it comes to, you know, the key available resources like aviation assets nationally and air tankers. When you consider the drought that we've experienced in Oregon, this is a key driver. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we had 25 of 36 counties across the state declared drought, and one of the implications there, of course, is the fire risk, and again, that played out. This is a good overall map to just at a glance key into some of the most significant fires that we experienced across the state. So I pulled out the perimeters on each of the largest fires. You've got the total acres burned on each of the fires, and then the ODF protected acres. As State Forester Doug Decker mentioned, we protect 16 million acres of fire protection. There's other jurisdictions in the state, Forest Service, BLM, who have protection responsibilities. I think the significance of this slide, as I reflect on the fire season, several of these fires made 30,000 acre runs in a burn period in an afternoon and through the evening. Just run the quick numbers here. That's 46 square miles of landscape across the state of Oregon consumed by fire in one evening, one afternoon, one burn period. Also of significance to recognize is as we attack fires such as the Canyon Creek fire, and they get up into the Strawberry Mountains, into the green section, the Forest Service up in the high country, where we can usually track these fires up into the high country and hold them up there when they make their runs. We saw fires get up into the high country, hold there, and then come back out with the next cold front that hit us down the other side, running across towards other communities. We had fires run through communities and back out the other side, consuming infrastructure, homes lost, significant losses of resources this year. And I just want to take a pause and highlight and recognize that this was a challenging year. Forest landowners, Oregonians across the state felt this fire season in ways that they haven't felt in the past. Very difficult season. So when I take a look at this since the 1960s, looking at a decadal view, the trend line for numbers of fires, which is the blue line, yeah, at a peak, we range from 1,600 fires. Our best years are down in 700 fires, but generally we're in that range. And this year was in that range. We were just above our 10-year average, 1,065 fires. But you look at the acres burned on the bar graph at the base, the last 3 years, unprecedented to have that type of conditions persistent, consistent year to year. And then generally looking at the full exposure in the second half of the graph compared to the first one, definitely more challenging fire seasons in terms of acres burned and the complexity we're seeing across the landscape. This equates to dollars lost. These are the costs of the last decade. Gross cost, $76 million to the state of Oregon for this fire season. Our net cost was at 29.6, so that's favorable. We did receive FEMA recoveries and cost recoveries from federal partners on joint jurisdictional fires, but significant impact on the financials also. Obvious significant impact to the loss. We have a complete and coordinated fire protection system that works, and this is a message I do want to relay. We were challenged, there's no doubt, but this is a system in Oregon that I'm very proud of to be a part of and be in the position of Matt, and it takes all hands, all lands. We have a great policy framework to operate in, and we used every nook and cranny of that to be successful over the past 3 years in terms of prevention, our suppression, the financials. It takes it all, and these are the folks coordinate with the stakeholders, our landowner partners, who do the work throughout the season. That this is expanding. This group of folks who participate is expanding because the fires are not stopping as they enter the rural communities now. We're challenged with this, and we're engaging with new partners over the past 3 years. This is an Oregon challenge collectively. I do want to highlight the uniqueness of this year on the Stouts Creek fire alone. Landowners stepped up. We had 15 overhead positions. These are leadership, trained, qualified people on the fire line, 40 pieces of equipment, yep. Built 28 miles of fire line in 5 days on the west flank of the fire. This is unique to Oregon, wow. This type of energy placed through the stakeholders, landowners, to be a part of the complete and coordinated system, and recognizing the loss in infrastructure this year, over 60 homes and outbuildings impacted this year, significant as you look at our averages. Our local fire departments, tremendous effort and the coordination it takes to deliver a complete and coordinated system shined this year in some significant challenges. What do we do next? We have to ask ourselves this. In 2004, we conducted a fire program review where we asked these questions. This is the time, again, to ask that question based on the past 3 years. With support from Representative Rayfield and Senator Devlin, conversations started around what's next several years ago. And we've been seeking their counsel and guidance and others to form a review committee to ask some specific questions on how do we continue to improve on this system. And there's three areas that we'd like to focus on within this committee's work. I'd like to highlight the colleagues that were selected on the committee. We worked through the House and the Speaker of the House and the Senate President to select representatives and senators, Kathleen Taylor, Representative Huffman, Representative Jean Wisnant, Senator Bill Hansel, Senator Betsy Johnson, Senator Michael Dembro, and Senator Edwards are all on the committee to help us with these challenges. We have three focus areas, and that is sustainable large fire funding. We know the challenges around managing the financials at the end of the fire season, the sustainable fire organization, as Doug alluded to, not just the militia, but are we organized appropriately in the face of this challenge before us on the fire landscape. And then the third piece, this is your realm. I know this committee as a policy committee has deliberated and discussed and had an interest in, you know, policy options available to us, and specifically for this topic, is to mitigate increasingly complex wildfire conditions in Oregon. So I would like to reach out to the committee and express an interest to continue to communicate on the fire program review and work through the chair to keep you up to speed on the progress. The last bullet here is a heavy lift. I said we used every policy nook and cranny that we have within our complete and coordinated system, but I think now's the time again to ask, is there anything else we need to explore? Federal policy on what's contributing to the risk, the prevention policies, or do we have the framework in which to respond appropriately? All those conversations need to be on the table. Included in the committee, of course, is the stakeholders, the landowners, and our partners in response. So this is a robust committee work. We initiated the committee starting this December, and we'll complete our work in June. So that's a tall order, but we have to be prepared for next fire season. There's some short-term goals of the committee in this framework, and then the long-term vision is towards the 17-19 biennial. Is there any legislative concepts in there to help us address these challenges? With that, thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Doug, just out of curiosity, where'd you grow up?
Oregon?
Yeah. No.
Must have been Northeast Oregon.
I don't see any webs between your fingers here.
East Boston, sir.
I thought I detected a little Bay State accent there. So.
A little. The chair grew up in Connecticut, I think.
Yeah. Where'd you get your forestry degree?
Florida. How does that make it?
He's a worldly traveler here. Thank you very much. And we would be very, very interested if as your committee does its work to have you update us on that would be tremendous. Lena, welcome to our committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean and Krieger. For the record, my name is Lena Tucker. I am the Deputy Chief for the Private Forest Division with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And I'm just going to give you a little quick review about the purpose of our division and the work that we do. Our goal is to help protect natural resources on all private lands and to help keep them healthy, intact, and working, especially at a time when the pressure to convert to non-forest uses is really rising. So our mission really rests on that premise that healthy, diverse private forest lands provide value to all Oregonians. Some of the sub-programs under my division include the Oregon Forest Practices Act Administration, Family Forest Landowner Technical Assistance. We do monitoring, forest health, the Urban and Forestry Community Forestry Program, and we also do work in genetics and tree improvement. So private forest lands make up about 34% of Oregon's total forest land base, which is 10.7 million acres. And they're divided between large industrial and corporate holdings that are managed primarily for timber production at 6 million acres, and then family forest lands, whose owners have a wide variety of goals for their lands, and they make up about 4.7 million acres. So serving family forest landowners is really a core business of the Oregon Department of Forestry. We do enforce the Forest Practices Act, which is a cornerstone of natural resource protection in Oregon. And we provide the services and the expertise needed and focused to keep those family forest landowners, their forest healthy, intact, and working. The wildfire season of 2015, as you all know, has really resulted in property losses and environmental impacts larger than we've seen in the past. Over 90,000 acres of private forest and rangeland has been lost, and most of this does belong to family forest landowners or non-industrial private landowners. And so landowner types are affected differently during stand level disturbance events. Industrial landowners, they have a lot of resources and they may be able to respond quickly to those types of events, but family forest landowners are less likely to have the resources at their disposal to respond quickly. And these disturbances, they can really disrupt planned forest management, harvest activities. They can force landowners to harvest at a loss due to poor return on salvaged wood or due to the cost of mandatory post-harvest activities such as reforestation. For example, some family forest landowners may only harvest once in their lifetime, especially in eastern Oregon. And, you know, they had plans for those resources, you know, perhaps retirement savings, college tuition, a legacy to pass down to their children. And so when a stand-level disturbance event happens, whether it's, you know, fire or insects or disease, you know, it really throws them off. You know, the plans that they had in place, they have to adjust quickly. Here's where our boots on the ground come in. These are our stewardship foresters. We have 51 of them spread across the state, and they all support the fire protection program. And they serve on fire teams or in support roles. And so after they return from their fire assignments, they don't get a break, but they're eager to get out there and interact with the landowners that they serve. And they do outreach, especially to the family forest landowners who were affected by these wildfires, and kind of get them going in the right direction, provide them with information on assistance programs, what their eligibility may be for certain programs, and what opportunities are out there from federal and state agencies. So at the same time after the fire, landowners are, you know, they're starting to pick up the pieces, as Doug said, and they have questions. You know, where do they start? They have concerns. Where do I get seedlings? What are the laws about salvage harvesting? And, you know, how do I go about rehabilitating and restoring my forest and my rangeland? So our existing programs with the Oregon Department of Forestry, we have staffing and support to provide a certain level of technical assistance to get landowners going. For example, our stewardship foresters will work with the landowners to, you know, weigh their options about salvage harvesting. And if federal funding or other state funding is available, to apply for grants or cost share. So just a quick review of funding. So this is the current funding makeup for the Private Forest Division. So historically, 60% general fund, 40% harvest tax, and this is for the purposes of administering the Forest Practices Act. We also receive some general fund support for forest health management, and that does leverage quite a bit of federal funding and other funds. However, family forest land technical assistance and urban forestry are solely federally funded. And historically, we've relied on the U.S. Forest Service, state and private grant funding to help fund this one-on-one technical assistance and outreach. It's our stewardship foresters getting out there and helping them with their management planning before they make that decision to harvest, before they file their first notification. So we're facing really some declining funding through our federal partners for both family forest land assistance and urban forestry. And so with this growing wildland-urban interface, mostly occupied by the family forest landowners, the demands for our services and other services and the complexity of that assistance we provide really has increased over the past few years. So at this time, we do not have any funding in the department to cost share with family forest lands owners to help rehabilitate their land after a fire. However, we've been working with the federal and state partners that we have to identify funds that may be available. So examples of funding that are coming through for those folks affected by fires include funds from the Natural Resource Conservation Service. So they're doing some cost share funding for erosion control and other mitigation practices, such as grass seeding. The Federal Farm Service Agency has funding available for reforestation of those affected areas, planting suitable trees, of course, and shrubs to help with the mitigation. And they're also funding fence repairs and spring development. And another exciting program that's come through, it's actually a pilot program. It's called the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program Pilot, and it's through FEMA. And so for those large fires that had a FEMA declaration, funds are coming into those counties. And we're hoping that a lot of funding could be used for really culvert replacement, drainage improvement. You've all heard of the stories up at Canyon Creek, you know, the concerns for large-scale flooding during this winter down that canyon. And so we're hoping some of those funds will help out with that. So we really do appreciate our partners and the funding that they are bringing to the table. It kind of brings us to some policy questions and where do we go next? So we've had extreme wildfire seasons for the past 3 years. And, you know, they're starting to raise questions of whether the Oregon Forest Practices Act and its associated administrative rules, as they're written, are we having unintended consequences? Are these outcomes that we're getting, are they contrary to the purpose of keeping working forests working? Are there barriers? So the Eastern Oregon Regional Forest Practice Advisory Committee, it's an advisory committee to the Board of Forestry. They've been discussing the relevance of our reforestation requirements after catastrophic events. And so they're really seeking to determine if the Forest Practices Act administrative rules are still achieving that purpose in light of a changing landscape, changing climate, the management effects, land uses, and the availability of emergency funding. So we've been looking at different requests that have come in to perhaps change reforestation requirements for those landowners who salvage harvest after a stand-damaging wildfire event. And so we spent a lot of time out there after the fires, myself, my staff, our stewardship foresters, and we visited with landowners at public meetings out in Baker County, there in John Day, the site of the Canyon Creek fire. And we listened and we learned about their struggle. And their struggle is really all about deciding, do I salvage harvest? Do I not? And if I do harvest, what type of, you know, what am I going to receive? What is the income that I'm going to receive from this wood? And they have to make those decisions pretty quick, especially in Eastern Oregon, the pine deteriorates rather quickly. And if I salvage harvest, then I know I have to reforest. Where am I going to find seedlings? Right now, demand totally outpaces the supply of seedlings, especially in Eastern Oregon. Mm. And I think some of the bigger questions that folks ask when we stand out there on the landscape and it's all black, it's standing dead trees, will the forest come back? You know, is if there's no trees left for natural regeneration, how long will it take for those forests to recover? Some of the other questions that are coming up, especially out there in the Canyon Creek area, you know, we were standing on one home site, the home was lost, and we were there to kind of look at, you know, their 10, 15 acres of forest land. And we visited with a logging contractor who was there to kind of salvage harvest the trees as well as clean up the remains of their home. And our stewardship foresters, they were keyed into this. They said, we can't go serve these landowners who've lost houses until, you know, they need to grieve, they need to heal. They need to figure out what they're doing with their home and their life, and then we'll come in and help them figure out what to do with their forest. So we're trying not to rush it. We're trying not to force them to make really quick decisions. And lastly, you know, we can work within our forest practices administrative rules to help you meet your overall goals. So pretty powerful discussions that I witness out there this year. We're taking a hard look at these areas, especially those lands that transition between sagebrush, there's sage grouse there, and juniper, and then it moves into the ponderosa pine forest. And somewhere in between, over time, those ponderosa pine stands have really encroached into that sagebrush ground. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at that marginal area, and we're trying to decide, does it make sense? Can we get a forest to grow there again? How did that forest get started? You know, the climate at one time was obviously better. And so we're trying to kind of examine those relationships to help landowners make decision about where their reforestation efforts are going to be most successful. So we're going to continue these conversations along with the Eastern Oregon Regional Forest Practices Committee. And we're going to make sure that if there are opportunities out there to modify our existing reforestation administrative rules, that we do it in total alignment with our current forest practices policy, and you know, help to achieve the wide variety of goals that our landowners are looking for across the landscape. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
You touched on it a little bit, but I contacted Menasha a while back, one of their foresters, because normally I can get my seedlings through them and say, hey, we don't even know if we can get the seedlings we need. So you're talking about getting either 1-0s or 1-1s trees. And when you have these huge fires, tens of thousands of acres, none of the nurseries are prepared to pre-plant without knowing what's available mm-hmm. and have that investment. So what are you doing about the time frame? I would normally plant in January, February, even though I got another year, second growing season, but I like to get them in right away. So what are you going to do about the availability of trees if they're not available? You got to give people an extra year or two or three or what? What are we going to do? And does the state have any capacity? Because it looks like we're in a three-year pattern. I think we're in a lot more than a three-year pattern. So you have the ability to get cones, you got the ability to put more trees in the ground. I think there's some nurseries available, forest nurseries available. What are we doing here?
No. So Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, you're absolutely right. We have the ability, and all of our stewardship foresters know this, we have the ability to extend the timeline requirements for reforestation. And events such as wildfire and other events such as, you know, lack of the availability of seedlings are all valid reasons to extend the reforestation timelines. We all understand that, and our foresters are working with landowners who are facing these issues. Now, with the J.E. Schroeder Seed Orchard does produce seed. It's a cooperative relationship, and within the Oregon Seed Bank, which has the ability to buy seed from the orchard, we do have a seed supply available for family forest landowners. However, that's about as far as we can go. We don't have the funding to take that seed, contract grow it in nurseries, and then provide it for family forest landowners. However, we do have the seed available. We have been working with OSWA, and we're encouraging family forest landowners to really kind of get together and form cooperatives, work with their local consulting foresters to kind of band together to put together orders of seedlings, you know, for the future. But you are correct. The supply is very limited, especially in these years when we see these unexpected and large fire occurrences.
Just to follow up, please.
Maybe to Doug. You work a lot with the forest cooperatives as far as like Coos Forest Patrol, Douglas Forest. We experienced down the coast, we went from level 2 to level 4, shut us down. 2 days later in level 4, for about a week, we were in fog, it was dripping, the roads were wet. We couldn't operate. Well, it appeared that I was looking, what is the criteria for going to level 4? The criteria was they didn't have any fire crews in case a fire broke out. And I'm not certain that that's allowed under the law. Can you address that?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. So on a daily basis, the industrial fire precaution levels fluctuate on a daily basis when we're in the heart of fire season, and our goal is to try to coordinate that across different jurisdictional boundaries. And that can be challenging. One of the key considerations that comes up in the determination of that has to do with who's home, what do the local resources look like. You're also looking at fuel moistures. You're looking at weather patterns and winds, et cetera. But certainly knowing that the barn is empty because everybody's over in John Day fighting fire, that definitely is a consideration that folks will make and can make when they make that determination. I think another complexity is, going across public and private land ownership boundaries and into different protection jurisdictions between CFPA, DFPA, ODF protection. And so that has to be coordinated on a regular basis so that you see, as orderly as possible, you see a kind of a common set of precaution levels. But resource availability is definitely one of those variables that our district foresters and the district managers are assessing.
Just as a comment, you have on the coast, you got, I think I had 50 loads of logs on the landing, nearly all on the landing, and we wanted to do some hauling. Couldn't do that. And we're talking about the end of September, and I've seen over there on the coast, all of a sudden, you've got rain, and you're not going to get in there till next spring. Well, of course, you know what that does to the value of your wood and everything else. So though we had unique circumstances, I think we're going to be dealing with those unique circumstances are going to become more of the norm. Maybe we need to be having a conversation on how we can accommodate some needs, especially when the conditions in right on that coastal zone, mm-hmm. when it gets down to where for 3 or 4 days of fog and it's dripping, you're not going to have a fire in there. So right. We need to have a little more latitude, I think, than what we were given.
I think you would find agreement that concern about the new normal or the new average, mm-hmm. No doubt about that. I think the other side of that is that in CFPA, in any particular jurisdiction, if there's nobody there to fight fire, it's a risk management question and a risk assessment that has to be done on a daily basis. And I would want you to know that that's not something that's arrived at capriciously. There's a lot of thought and discussion amongst the members of the association when that level is set.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question. I'm not even sure how to ask the question. I know what I'm after, but I'll try and explain it as best I could. And maybe I should wait until Chad does his presentation. But if we were to look at the percentage of forests that burn by ownership, so states X percent, small industrial private X percent, right on through, are we at risk in any of the ownership categories of fires just chasing around the landscape, and we're literally managing to replace entire forests by fire over time?
Chair Witt, there are significant portions of our districts up in our Northeast Oregon district. In one particular unit, the fire up there this summer burned a high percentage of lands that we protect in that one unit. So. Yeah. Depending on the location of the fire, that's possible. In Oregon, we had about 90,000 acres of state protection burned. That's largely private and BLM. There was about, I think the number is about 640,000 acres total burned in Oregon. So the majority of that would be on federal land, mm-hmm. Over on the east side. The costs associated with that, Doug just mentioned, this morning we were before the Ways and Means Sub, and we basically asked for an additional, the total extra cost was about $76 million in addition to the $45 million base. And so that's us. That's the state's share. The feds spent about $250 million in Oregon, just under $1 billion in Oregon and Washington fighting fire. So the natural resource impacts at a localized level, as you've described, as well as the financial aspects of that are significant, much less to think about what's happening in the market. I mean, I think one of the things that that, you know, one of the phenomena that Lena and our stewardship foresters see in a localized market that's heavily affected by fire is the mill basically can't take any more burned logs. And so mm-hmm. that landowner who had that as an investment, you know, they there's a significant discount factor there because the market just can't handle that much.
Before we shift on to Chad, Lena, I want to mention and take note of the approach, the enlightened approach that you have taken. The seeds aren't available, and we're going to extend the period of time until that folks have to meet the free to grow requirement. That is refreshing. As a regulator, you know, that's music to my heart. I'm glad to see that we have regulators that take that enlightened approach. And I've talked to a number of people on this committee, and it is so frustrating to us when we hear from state agencies that are locked into regulatory frameworks, and there's no flexibility, and people, it's impossible for people to meet that compliance requirement, and for you to step forward and have that enlightened approach, I just want to thank you, and I want to thank the entire department for taking that approach. That is good government. That's responsible government. That's government that's responsible and lives in the real world. So thank you.
Pass that on.
Thank you.
Chad, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Witt, Representative McLean, Representative Krieger. For the record, my name is Chad Davis, and as State Forester Decker mentioned, I do manage the Federal Forest Health Program at the department. I feel blessed to do so. As you all know, Oregon is one of the few states investing in federal forests, and actually the only state investing in the way that we are. And so I think that's something that we can all hang our hats on. But we also all know that the eyes of the country are upon us, and I don't take that lightly as a responsibility of looking at this. The question that the chair just asked is a good lead into this, relative to part of the economic analysis that went kind of behind this work and kind of working with the legislature on this opportunity was to look at the cost of switching funds over from the suppression side, particularly in the federal budget, over to the prevention side. An analysis that was conducted by Mason, Bruce, and Gerard showed that for every dollar invested in restoration, saved $1.45 in suppression. How does that matter? Well, a dollar is a dollar, even if it's a state dollar or a federal dollar. So the way I think about that is every dollar that the state invests, it saves the federal government $1.45 in suppression. The trick is we hope they also are spending that $1.45 then back on their prevention side and matching ours at least 1.45 to 1. So with that, I am going to talk a little bit about the program. As you all remember, we're heading into our second biennium. We have one-time funding in 13-15, followed up by one-time funding in 15-17. So I'm going to talk a little bit about both of those at a different number. The first biennium around, the state invested $2.8 million, and in the 15-17 biennium, the state invested $5 million. A little bit difference in scope, the first biennium and a lot of the results that I'll show today were focused in the dry side, or mostly in eastern Oregon and particularly up in northeast Oregon. The program that we're operating in 15-17 is statewide because that was the legislature's want. So, again, starting looking backwards a little bit to look forward, obviously this program functions with kind of a two-pronged approach. One is supporting kind of a huge Oregon asset in our local forest collaboratives. And a lot of you have spent time on the ground, and I've spent a lot of time talking to you about forest collaboratives, and I appreciate your interest in that approach. So I'll cut to the chase and say, not to try to describe what a forest collaborative is anymore, but to say that what we're starting to do and what we're starting to see and what we're trying to start to compile is, are these individual localized groups having an effect at the regional or at the statewide scale? And so a lot of the results I'm going to refer to are out of a monitoring guidebook that I asked the University of Oregon and Oregon State University to compile some impact results of this work. The take home here, this is again the top bullet bullet point is really just in the four national forests of the Blues Mountains up in northeast Oregon. That records of decisions, so that's project decisions that a line officer in the Forest Service is signing and implementing into action, were signed on 137,000 acres over last biennium on those four national forests. And then those five groups in that same region were working on an additional 456,000 acres. So the question has always been, well, when do you check it and say accomplished, right? So we're trying to look at a couple different metrics of that. The proof in the pudding, we'll see, does the bottom bullet, does the 465 transition into the top bullet over time? Do we see more records of decision signs? Because that's the actual opportunity for the forest to move forward. At a different scale, the second bullet is only on the Malheur National Forest. So another critique or a question around these collaborative projects is, do they actually result in any logs on the truck? And so what we're seeing that contracts coming out of collaborative projects, again, on the Malheur National Forest, if we looked at each forest, it would be a different answer here. It was a pretty significant number. And in terms of particularly when you're talking about Grant and Harney County and keeping that infrastructure rocking and rolling over there. So the question then becomes, well, is collaborative agreement, is social process, is all of that sitting around in rooms and coming up with suggestions to the forest, is that actually translating to work on the ground? And these are the next two slides are trying to attempt to do that. So one, looking at regional economic impact. Again, this is looking at the state of Oregon's investment, kind of comparing on the left side, 2009-2011 time period, to the biennium of which the state put its initial funds on the table, 2012-2014. And the take-home here is down in the green box in the right-hand corner, that we saw jobs increase in eastern Oregon, so this is only looking at jobs in eastern Oregon, east of the Cascades, from forest restoration activities off of the national forest by 16% in that time period. Is every bit of that responsive of the $2.8 million? No. We had a little bit of an economic uptick in that time period as well. But again, another trend line, we're saying, are things improving? Is this kind of approach starting to get us somewhere? So that's kind of a jobs look. And then the other looks that kind of come into here are obviously acres treated, and then some folks are more even clued in on the timber piece of this. So this graph tries to do both, with the blue bars being kind of the timber volume piece. Again, this is just for the Malheur National Forest. Then the green line and the purple line in particular are kind of acres treated. One of the green line is commercial, and it's kind of hard to see. The green line is commercial timber sales, and the blue line is kind of pre-commercial thinning. So those projects that require more cost than they have revenue associated with them. Again, this is a good two-year trend. What we'll want to see and what we want to see throughout the next biennium implementing this program, and what I think this baseline monitoring work is how to do, is to start to understand and be able to track these things and to say, are we getting more? Are we staying same? Or hopefully not, are we decreasing on these kinds of metrics over time? So the program in 15-17 is similar in terms of what we're actually doing, the actions that we did in 13-15, with some key differences. And I mentioned the statewide scope earlier. We got more legislative direction. So we got a 2.8 chunk of money in the first biennium. This, we got a little more direction on where to spend that money. And the collaborative support arm of the program, we have $1.3 million. And then the implementation partnership piece, and I'll talk about what these two are, more of a 3-to-1 kind of a number there. The collaborative support piece, we talk a lot about increasing pace and scale. You'll hear us say that. You'll hear State Forester Decker say that. The collaborative support piece in my view of the program is the part that's about expanding kind of the, I'm going to get this wrong, expanding the scale part of this. So we're trying to scale up that kind of social agreement, the opportunity to work. In some collaborative groups, that might be going from 5 acres to 1,000 acres. In some collaborative groups, that's going from 50,000 to 100,000 acres. And so what we're trying to do is design the program in a way that allows a local group to work at the pace that they're used to working at. But we're asking them the same question. How is this grant activity going to increase the scope of your and the scale of your agreement? And then I think by boiling those results up at the level is kind of what we start to look at and start to look at impact. So, for example, we're working with OWEB in particular in this collaborative support piece to kind of administer some competitively awarded grants to the collaborative groups. And one grant was awarded to the Wallowa Whitman Collaborative in particular to engage with the Forest Service on the Lower Joseph Creek project. Most of these collaborative groups have started in the 5 to 10,000 acre kind of project size. That group decided to start at 100,000 acres. And you know, that created some challenges, it created some opportunities, and I think, but I think in the end, that was a good success, and we'll see some of that work hopefully start to hit the ground soon. And I do expect through this, in terms of asking collaborative groups, folks will probably want to talk about salvage in a little bit. I do expect some groups are starting to think about what is the next phase of their collaboration. And so another thing we're looking for in terms of just scaling up agreement is kind of also expanding kind of the suite of, are we just talking about ponderosa pine stands? Are we starting to talk about more complex issues? And I can tell you that that's happening, and it's good to see that in terms of the grant requests that we're getting back. The implementation partnership piece is really about ODF using state contracts and or state employees to really assist the Forest Service and in this biennium, the BLM, to get the work done that we typically think of that happens between project initiation and handing it off to a contractor. So we've not used any of these funds necessarily to pay for prescribed burning or pre-commercial treatments or those kinds of things. Oregon actually is blessed with some funds to do that through some federal sources and some other things called the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program. The barrier in Oregon has always been the planning side of the ledger. And so we've taken some of these funds and said, how do we get more better data into the system quicker? And then how do we, once we have a record of decision or an environmental analysis done, how do we get that sale laid out and moved on into the hands of a contractor to actually go ahead and implement that? So we've kind of done a twofold piece of that. And this is the arm of the program, which I would say is talking about increasing the pace. So the question that we ask when we do these investments in coordination with the Forest Service is, what are we testing? We're not just throwing more money at this. We're not just doing status quo. But what about this business practice is different? So I've talked to this committee before about the use of LIDAR. I've talked to this committee about the use of contract crews to do some of the layout work. Those are the types of things that we're trying to testing and kicking around to see if we can't find efficiencies, both cost and time, within the system. Under this implementation partnership piece, just tagging on to the fire discussion, we've been able to extend some of our seasonal positions. Right now, today, I'm happy to say we got 30 ODF folks in the woods on Forest Service ground, working with Forest Service employees to lay out Forest Service timber sales all across Eastern Oregon. And I was blown away when I queried my team for how many folks that we actually had done that to, and that's more than last biennium. So the uptake, both internally with us and the uptake with the Forest Service asking us for help is definitely more at a scale this time than last biennium even. I also say with this funding this time around, we also got some position authority, and that relates specifically to those seasonal extensions that I just talked about. But we're also going to hire some folks and put them in the field. Last time I tried to coordinate the whole program from Salem, you guys appreciate the challenges that is when you're working in John Day and Lakeview and all the other places that our folks are located. So we're going to put some folks in the ground with their on the ground with their specific intention to work closely with the Forest Service to find those opportunities to, again, test these new practices and to keep our folks employed and keep things moving forward. So I did want to close with just talking about, you know, in Salem we talk a lot about our fire program or our private forest program or our federal forest health program. In the field, those lines blur pretty quickly, and it's a lesson that I've learned in my 3 years on the job at ODF. And so thinking about how these programs, and particularly the federal forest program, hits the ground, I'm reminded of, you know, it's the $5 million program. We talk about it that way a lot. But it's really part of a bigger change that's happening across the landscape. So Doug could talk to you a lot about the National Cohesive Wildfire Strategy, which has been successful. It's a national pilot that they've got running over there that technically resides, I think, in our fire program. But it has attracted federal funds through NRCS to work with private landowners in that kind of general geography. The Forest Service has committed a significant amount of money to something called the Accelerated Restoration Program. That is the team that they handed off that 100,000-acre first project on the Wallowa Whitman to and said, go do NEPA differently. We need to answer the question. They finished that project, handed it back to the Wallowa Whitman. They've moved on to the next project, which is actually 400,000 acres. So they're taking the next big step forward to work forward on that. And then obviously our forest health program has done kind of what I've described. So we're looking at that kind of collaborative piece, and we're also looking at kind of the data collection piece. So what we're trying to do is to think about this as a system, and how do we have these impacts across, really across an all lands kind of scale, using the buckets and kind of the programmatic structure and silos that we have, but really start to put some more of a strategic lens across the whole thing.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt, followed by Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering if you could discuss your outcomes on the Wainema-Fremont Collaborative. It's my understanding that it's not going well, that there are still holdups on logging on there, that environmental groups, which are signed on as part of the collaborative, are refusing to allow even the burned-up logs to have been is that true?
So, Chair Witt, Representative Hildreth Whitsitt, I appreciate the question. I honestly would have to check in with my friend Jim Walls down on the Fremont Wainema closer to verify that. Salvage is definitely a controversial piece, and I am aware of the situation I think you're referring to there on the Fremont Wainema. I do think that there's a lot of positive things happening on the Fremont Wainema, too, and in fact, I would have to give some credit to the Forest Service there that they're pushing the envelope more relative to what they call designation by prescription and this thing called virtual boundaries. They're really trying to do some things to reduce their cost. Those things are being not only supported by the collaborative group, they're actually being, so the Nature Conservancy has been really, really involved in helping push forward and do some study design about how those things come into fruition. I think as a result of Oregon's investment, the regional office got national, from the Washington office, got some pilot authority to actually implement that project, which is going above and beyond what the Forest Service is doing anywhere nationally. So I agree with you that, yes, there are challenges, particularly as it relates to salvage, no doubt about it. There are some positive things that are happening in different parts of the state, and I think it's our responsibility to talk about some of those things and to help push some of those further along.
If I may follow up.
Please.
I'm concerned about the massive amounts of public dollars going into this, and we are not seeing in certain areas of the state any result from this, and people going back on their word, and we're just not seeing it. So I think that you need, when you do your presentations, to also show where it's not working, because you give us a really happy picture, and it's not a happy picture down our way. So that would be just some advice for the future.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll follow up with you of kind of our inside loop
great.
On how things are going there.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a little bit of follow-up on that maybe, but over where we are, we talked yesterday about the salvaging the burnt timber, and the mills are kind of saying, you know, we got enough. But does that affect the collaborative, like at Little Joe, you know, when they're talking about harvesting up there, and yet here they got, they'll have all of this timber from the Grizzly Fire? Does that slow down their processes then?
So, Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, that is a follow-up to a good question you asked yesterday. And I would say that the impact largely from the salvage or not to salvage decision largely is because there's not a lot of other bodies to go do both at the same time. So you mentioned Lower Joe. What the Forest Service is already telling me is that these 30 folks that are on the field are allowing their what they call their green program work to continue while they have dedicated their staff into their bear teams, soil stability after fire, and starting to do some assessment over particularly roadside salvage up on Grizzly Bear and on Canyon Creek in particular. So I would not say that I know that it's had any impact necessarily yet on the collaboratives. But I do think that it has the potential to do that, and I do think that that's where the state dollars have been. They've been a good, kind of plug in the boat to kind of keep that green sale program moving along, which otherwise would be a little bit derailed. And I do know that there are some places on the Umatilla National Forest is one where some decisions have been put off because the teams are out doing other things in kind of response to the fire situation.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was asking is it, are they going to respond basically to how much burn timber they have to harvest so they don't harvest the green stuff then and it gets put on hold?
Well, there's a, Chair Witt, Representative Brito, there is a capacity issue with getting that timber out to market. Once it's out to market, once it's out to sale, right, then it's obviously in the hands of the contractors about when they want to do the harvesting. So I think, again, that's why we've been focused on get it to market, get these projects in the hands of contractors, and then hopefully things will start to roll a little bit quicker.
Can I follow up? Sure. And then a couple of slides back, you had, I think, where we increased the number of jobs right there.
Yep.
16%. Now, are all those jobs private sector jobs where you get into the categories up there? Question. You got forest and watershed, and I'm wondering if those are state jobs.
So I will have to follow up with you on that. I don't know. I do know that the two on the right-hand side, I believe, since there's not probably a nonprofit or a state-owned timber processing facility or meal processing facility,
yeah,
are private sector jobs. But I'll look at that one in particular. Note, that's the one that went down in all of these. And then the other thing I would note about that forest and watershed jobs, we've never had a good estimate of that. So part of the work that we did here was to start to say, what are the other aspects of restoration that are creating jobs in these communities?
Yeah.
And I can follow up with you more specifically on that.
Can I have one more follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. And then, Doug, I think you said that the cost of fighting fire was $122 million this year?
Or the total cost, including the base as well as the large fire cost, was in that neighborhood, correct?
Okay. And then the amount of assets or timber that was burned, is that, do you have that amount?
We do not have that. That's, in fact, we've never really, the state has never really been able to track that. That would be kind of protected information by individual landowners, and so we don't roll that up. We talk about acres burned, but we really don't talk about volume per se. You can make some projections.
Yeah.
I don't have a direct board foot accounting of that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I realize, you know, you don't want any more to burn, so we spend a lot of money to prevent further burn, but you wonder about the cost of putting out the fires versus how much material is burned up, and are we spending more putting out the fires than we're saving, I guess, is the question.
And I think that is a growing concern. Apologies for stepping out at 3 o'clock. They're running a little bit late,
but
so
all right.
I'm back. You know, one of the, when you look at the kind of the trend line for firefighting costs versus the value that's generated from the volume that's there, right now, the U.S. Forest Service is estimating that by the year 2025, 66% of their entire budget, not their fire budget, their entire agency budget will be spent on firefighting.
Yeah.
And that's just a reflection of the risk that's presented by those landscapes right now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I know that we have pine, you know, we have Lodgepole, Ponderosa, and of course we have pine over on the west side. And then we have Douglas fir, and then we have the white wood species, the spruce and the, you know, the white fir and things of this nature. How long, what is the time frame for those species? You got three classifications, white woods, Doug fir, and pine. I know pine blooms in about a year. What about Doug fir and then the whitewoods? It seems like the whitewoods would go quicker than the Doug fir, of course. But what's the time frame on that?
They're looking at
or
me to answer that
question. You can't salvage it.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I don't know, but I think that you're right in terms of progression. Pine is it blooms the fastest, then the whitewoods, then the Douglas fir. But I also have heard, I think, that folks in the industry say within an 18-month time period is when you kind of need to be getting it off the stump.
But the Doug fir and the whitewoods?
I believe that's just a general number that I've always heard.
Mm-hmm. Now, follow up,
please.
I want to share with you what I've heard when we had the biscuit fire. We had an environmental group come in and say, you know, when that burnt, it was equivalent of everyone in the state of Oregon driving their cars for 10 years mm-hmm. with the footprint. Then I also heard later, by letting it lay there and deteriorate, it was the equivalent of everyone in the state of Oregon driving their car for 100 years. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't understand why we object to salvaging.
And that topic is actually there. I was just there. They're discussing that at this moment. I think the science of carbon sequestration and the decomposition of wood products, whether they're on the stump or on the ground or sequestered in the buildings around us, is fairly complicated. And I've experienced, like you, I've people who can argue it in either direction. I think the reality is that I think history has shown us that when we don't do some level of salvage, we look at our Tillamook Burn up in the northwest corner, we know that fire will return to that landscape.
Yes.
And will create risk for neighboring mm-hmm. neighboring landowners. Mm-hmm. And that's a concern and cost.
What was interesting, it came out of the same mouth. So, I don't know.
Some level of consistency. Something was the same anyways. Vice Chair McLean.
One of the questions I had on the last presentation was the fact that, you know, you indicated that we are a unique program because we're one of the only states that's putting some money into the partnership. And I think I've said before at different times that, you know, prevention is important to me, and I know it's more difficult to prevent with the landscape that we're given right now. But I was wondering, as far as the program right now, how much is actually planning for the partnership or the sharing of preventative type measures, whether it be cutting brush or whatever else that we need to do?
Yes, thanks for the question, Chair Witt and Representative McLean. We talked about that a little bit, I think, yesterday as well. And we have been focused on the planning side of this. With some focus, my understanding from the legislature was it had to have a jobs. This, you know, primary the reason, one of the primary focuses the legislature was interested in doing this work was a jobs piece. And the linkage, before we had this box on the left-hand side, was much more clear and direct through the timber infrastructure in the forest sector that we do have in the state and blessed to have. And so that is the bias that I have used in terms of how we've funded this work. There's no doubt that there's tons of other work out there, prescribed fire, pre-commercial thinning, culvert replacements, et cetera, that can be done. And I think as a state we can figure that out, because I think they do have jobs opportunities for Oregonians, but it is a different little bit of a calculus with those jobs and the ones that we're maybe more familiar with.
And I would add that there is a different flavor of federal funds that come through the U.S. Forest Service state and private forestry branch that we use, that we're utilizing right now doing fuels management on private ground, particularly on the east side, and I don't have that number in the tip of my tongue, but there's a significant amount of direct prevention dollars in addition to the pace and scale work that Oregon's funding.
Representative McEwen, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Don, this is just a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you coming here with this level of detail. We had an opportunity to visit over east a few weeks ago and see some of the ramifications of what happened way over in the northeast this summer. But following you, we have a presentation on the multi-species plan, and it brings to mind for me a question of when you're going in to do restoration work on these fires, how much coordination is there with ODFW on looking at those streams that have fish issues in the future, and how coordinated are you with them when you're looking at where you're going to put those resources in doing the restoration work to do stream protection?
Maybe give you an example here. Good question.
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen. That's actually it's kind of part of the planning process. And so, you know, after a stand level disturbance event, wildfire, catastrophic insects disease outbreak, you know, our stewardship foresters, once again, they're working with a landowner to try to figure out what the landowner's goals are for their forest lands afterward. And if we're lucky enough that the landscape had kind of a patchwork or mosaic burn, you know, that that does provide some diversity, some allowances for, you know, differing habitat requirements of wildlife. Oftentimes, our stewardship foresters will bring in extension agents or OSU extension agents who have expertise, perhaps in wildlife habitat restoration. They'll work with fish and wildlife folks, you know, to look at mitigation practices for erosion, keeping out the unwanted invasive weeds that could come back, and what are the right practices on the landscape to do that. For example, took a look at a piece of ground that burned in 2012 down there, the Berry Point fire, and we looked at what the landowner had done to do restoration after his landscape. His goal, of course, was to try to get his forest replanted, and he happened to live kind of in that transition land again between the sagebrush and the juniper and the ponderosa pine. And so in areas where pine had grown, perhaps it won't get established there anytime soon just because of the climate conditions. However, he worked with Fish and Wildlife to look at forage cover crop seeding for the winter mule deer habitat down there. And so he was able to acquire seed, grass seed, to basically put in a forage crop, work with our local stewardship forester to get trees replanted where they'd have the most likely chance of success of growing and becoming forest again. So again, our stewardship foresters are working with the other agency experts, again, to try to put into play what those landowners' values, what their goals are for their objectives. There's a lot of opportunities, especially during the post-fire erosion control mitigation efforts, to look at how we stabilize stream banks, especially if a lot of these fires, you know, they went up one side of the mountain, down through the drainage and out the other end. So they really did burn a lot of the riparian areas. So again, working with Farm Services Agency, Natural Resource Conservation Service, we can find funding to rehabilitate the shrub, get the shrubs regenerated in our riparian areas. If they're doing salvage harvesting or some felling practices to prevent erosion from running down the steep slopes, there's great opportunities to do wood placement in those streams at the same time the equipment's there to provide for future habitat for the fish after the environment gets restored. Does that touch on some of the ideas and things that we're seeing?
I think it does. I think I was kind of keying on Representative Witsit's concern. We have a finite amount of resources, whether it's through ODF&W or for what you're doing, and when we're trying to restore this landscape, how do we make sure that we're expending those appropriately, that we're actually getting the work done that we need to get done? But then in the salvage, but then also restoring it to a way that has an eye towards the health of the environment when it comes to fish passage and all of those things that you know we all talk about in here every single day. So the coordination piece is kind of where I'm headed. Are you talking to folks? Everybody's coming together. There's more eyes on it than just let's go put in a culvert. Yeah. We all want that. We all want it restored well. But are we spending our dollars wisely in that regard in a coordinated way? So thank you.
With that, I want to thank our panel members as well as the entire department for an entirely interesting presentation and the good work that you do for our state every day.
We'll pass that along.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now we're going to switch gears and have an informational meeting. I'm going to close the informational meeting on the fire season and open one on the Coastal Multi-Species Conservation Plan. And for the background in that, I'd like to call forward, please, Ed Bowles and Tom Rumright. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for making yourselves available. Please determine among yourselves, between yourselves.
Well, I think I will go first.
All right.
Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles, the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we're going to start, and I'm here with Tom Rumreich, and he's going to talk more about his experience on the South Coast in the Coos Bay area on some of the STEP programs that he's been the steward of for quite some time, and kind of bring those insights into the hatchbox issue as well as just fish production and community engagement overall. But I was asked to give kind of a update on the Coastal Multi-Species Plan, and so that's where I'll start and walk you through that. I'm going to share with you a bit of the background, and I think there was some interest in the public engagement side of things, so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then looking forward from here, chat about the implementation and where we're going from here. Obviously, all these planning efforts are somewhat meaningless if the fish don't see the fruits of that, and so we do want to talk about the implementation side. Whoops. Yeah. First, to ground you in one of the fundamental policies that kind of undergird all of our conservation planning across the state. This is a native fish conservation policy adopted well over a decade ago. And basically, three kind of foundational pieces to that. The first one is to prevent serious depletion of our native fishes. The second one is to maintain and restore these, so to go beyond just preserving them, but to restore them to levels that are providing societal and ecological benefits. And then the third one is, on this platform of conservation, make sure we're doing everything we can to support commercial, tribal, and sport fisheries. So we've been busy since this policy was embraced and adopted over the past decade, really focusing on the planning side, working not just on our state conservation plans, but also on federal ESA recovery plans. And we've pretty well knocked off most of the plans required to provide that foundation for all of our anadromous fish, the sea run fish. We've got a couple still left to go, but well over two dozen of those completed, and we're really shifting to this implementation side. So this coastal plan, I wanted to just touch on some things that are a bit different here, because obviously much of the rest of the state has most of its anadromous fish listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. We're blessed on the coast that other than coastal coho salmon, which I will talk about separately, but this plan was really about those non-listed species. So we've got a bit of luxury there in that, first off, we don't have a pending crisis per se relative to their conservation or to their fisheries. And we had we decided to take another tact beyond just establishing the conservation platform, but actually talk about how we're managing these species, their harvest, their hatchery management, going beyond just the conservation piece. And then looking at this from a portfolio standpoint across basins, across species, something we really hadn't done before. The planning area all the way from Cape Blanco on the south, including the Elk River, all the way up to the mouth of Columbia, Nesquin or Nakanicum. And we're looking at these different groupings of fish, the different runs of Chinook, as well as summer and winter steelhead, chum, coastal cutthroat, and I'll chat about coho, which is has a separate plan, and I'll touch on that at the end because I want to share with you some recent developments there on the recovery plan and potential movement towards delisting. So the public involvement side was very robust. This was over a two-year process. We did have professional facilitation of numerous stakeholder teams. I think we had five stakeholder teams. We had legislative touch bases and oversight. I think midway through, we actually had somewhat, and Chair Witt, you'll recall this, somewhat of almost a pause, if you will, to re-engage with our public on this. And I think that was a very helpful guidance from you and allowed us to reground and get folks more completely involved. And that pause, then we moved forward from there with town hall meetings. I think before this was all done, in addition to all the stakeholder involvement, we had I think seven or eight town hall meetings, and then of course commission hearings and rulemaking, which culminated in adoption June of 14. And I will just say on the process moving forward, and when the legislature through your oversight got involved, things were pretty dicey. I mean, there was a lot of confusion, a lot of concern. A lot of it was just communication problems and information that wasn't clear. We were able to, and some of that just goes hand in with any major undertaking across this big of an area. But by the time it was all said and done, we were able to come together through a series of compromises and give and take with a plan that was unanimously supported by our Fish and Wildlife Commission. and by the major stakeholder teams that were involved with this. Not everybody was happy, but in the world I live in, far more were happy than usual for a big public process. And there was a lot of excitement in actually getting forward and implementing some of this. There was something very tangible and real for every party in here that they could get their hands around. And really, we've had phenomenal follow-up by many of our public sector working with us to implement. So I'm just going to touch, and I don't know how much detail you want on the nuts and bolts of this. And so, Chair Witt, if you give me the accelerator button, I'll move forward much quicker. But this is just to show you what's going on the coast. And these are for several of the species groupings across. And obviously, green is good. Red is not good. And the picture here on the species, and this is the status of these, is we have very healthy populations of wild fish on our coast, and we should be very proud of that. There's almost nowhere else in the lower 48 where you have this. Not only where we have vibrant wild populations of salmon and steelhead, but that these are they're healthy enough to be contributing directly to fisheries and local economies. That is something to cherish and really champion that Oregon has that almost nowhere else in the nation. And the reasons for that are many cases due to our phenomenal contribution of our public and working with us on the management of these. I would point out that on Chinook, there is a right down on that little south piece, Elk River. I will, you know, that is in Representative Krieger's backyard, and so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then the Spring Chinook, one of the forks of the Umpqua, the south fork of the Umpqua, were of concern. And then Chum, very great species we actually don't have within our fisheries, and that is one we know very much less about, but where we do have information, it appears to be plugging along okay, but it is one where we do have concerns. So the kind of status and limiting factors, current status is remarkably good, as I mentioned, except for Chum and a few population. Caution is warranted, but we're not in a crisis. Our desired status is to actually improve on this to ensure the conservation and then to build even stronger fisheries. The factors that are constraining these populations are varied. We do have a few areas where hatchery practices need to be modified and improved on. We also have some areas where we need to be concerned about harvest, particularly with Chinook. Predation, you may have heard that we do have a predation issue on the coast, both with pinnipeds and avian cormorants.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
An acknowledgement.
Yes.
Write this down, date and time and hour.
Duly noted.
You're going to get a little quote up there on my wall.
Yeah.
Along with McIntosh.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Also, across the board, the importance of habitat. I mean, when I mentioned earlier about the uniqueness of our Oregon's coast relative to producing these wild, healthy runs and that even support fisheries, it's really because I call them our natural hatcheries are really doing well on the coast, and it's an investment we've been investing in for a long time, but there's more to be done on that. So I'll touch on two of the things that we manage as the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Those are hatchery and harvest components. Look at this as kind of two ledgers. One is what are we going to do with this plan to improve conservation? And then on the right side be what are we doing to improve the opportunity, that being fisheries, is another way of saying it. So we did, on the conservation side, we did consolidate some of our hatchery programs. There were five of those that were consolidated into other areas, and this is getting at that portfolio approach of that allows us to get more into wild fish emphasis areas and hatchery fish emphasis areas. This was a source of much consternation and a lot of the conflict and controversy associated with this. And so there was a lot of give and take on this front before the plan was finalized. We did reduce some hatchery releases in three areas where there's a focus on reducing hatchery fish on the spawning grounds and then designating wild fish emphasis areas. Now, on the opportunity side, increasing some hatchery releases in 11 areas, adding new hatchery programs. There were three brand new spring Chinook hatchery programs that were added. As you may be aware, that was not funded last session through a bill, but it is something that we are still committed to doing should the funding come forward, and that is in the Coos, the Yaquina programs that are new. We were able to absorb and increase the spring Chinook programs in the Nestucca and the Tillamook on our own, okay? But there's two that are still.
So, Ed, in terms of reducing hatchery fish on spawning grounds, are they just harvested before they spawn, or what? How is that achieved?
Chair Witt, I'll use an example of Elk River to show you some of the things we're doing, because that's one of the ones that we're focused on, and it's quite a suite of actions.
Okay. Thank you.
So the hatchery portfolio, if you look at the map on the left, this shows the area, and the blue areas are wild fish emphasis areas where hatchery fish are not released. And then these gradations of green represent hatchery programs with, I think the yellow ones are ones where we actually have 3 to 4 versus 1 or 2. And this shows you kind of that portfolio of different emphasis areas that was allowed us to move forward in a way that not only got the conservation groups on board with the plan, but also the fishery groups and local groups through this portfolio approach. And we're trying to move away from where we have to fight this good fish, bad fish debate in every watershed, and instead lock in for a decade or more on a strategy that looks across the board, across species, and says, now let's just move forward with this and we'll learn from the results, but we're not going to try to be all in or all out everywhere. And on the right-hand side, if you look at hatchery releases, and this surprised a lot of people coming out of this planning effort, because as you're well aware, many folks thought that we were implementing this process in order to shut down hatcheries. And if you'll look on the right, the green is the hatchery releases, for the current in the blue, and the green would be the coastal plan. And we went from just under 6 million for the whole area on the coast up to 6.3 million. So we've actually increased support for additional hatchery fish. And you can see which regions, those are the north, mid, Umpqua, and the mid-south represented. And then the programs, the consolidation did show up, but it's pretty modest relative to the overall, with the new plan did consolidate some programs. On harvest side, on the conservation ledger, if you will, we do have a sliding scale harvest in place. So when the sun's shining and the fish are flourishing, we want to take advantage of those through more robust fisheries. And when things go south, so to speak, relative to, for example, ocean conditions or other things, then we need to be willing to tighten our belt relative to harvest. And we've got that in place, and we'll be managing based on that. We also have protective periods of fishing for some of the early run components that are much less abundant, and then establishing the thresholds. And on the improved fishing side, if you will, this sliding scale harvest works both ways. So when things are good, like they were the last 2 years, we had very robust fisheries and fairly robust limits. We've had stable wild coho fisheries. I regret that we may not be able to hold on to that with the ocean conditions that we're seeing. But so far, we've had actual fisheries on listed ESA fish in a very conservation-oriented way approved by the federal NOAA fisheries. New wild steelhead harvest opportunities, 3 of those. A little bit surprising note there. The department was about the only group really supporting those. The conservation groups and the fishing groups tended to not want to harvest wild steelhead, except perhaps in the Umpqua. That was quite controversial, but we found reticent support for that. But we did get 3 of those new programs. And then these three new spring Chinook fisheries I talked about.
Mr. Chair.
Who was that lucky fisherman, by the way?
Ed, can you go? Is that one of those in-figure hatchery fish, the way it looks?
Just one of the smaller jacks, I think.
Yeah. I don't see any adipose fin back there.
Right, right. We also have very serious consideration of these other factors, predators, habitat, and then the monitoring program so that we can adapt and learn and adapt as we go with this program. I'm not going to get into the details there, but we've been able to provide some really good oversight to the habitat management entities on what is ailing the fish and where to focus habitat actions, and I think that's a really exciting thing. No longer, you know, really doing random acts of kindness for fish in the watersheds. It's very focused on the pieces of the puzzle that are really needed in order to provide healthy habitats. So, Chair Witt, you had mentioned about the stray rates, and I said, you know, moving forward with implementation, I'm going to use one example area, which is Elk River Chinook, way on the southern end of this, off Cape Blanco. It is actually currently in a red status. We need to get that to green. And one of the key reasons it's in red status is because there's too many hatchery fish on the spawning grounds. It's no fault of the hatchery fish or fault of the hatchery per se. It's just that that hatchery is sited right in the middle of spawning grounds. Mm-hmm. And the hatchery gets its water from the river rather than from a tributary. And so getting the fish to go into it when there's no unique signature is a challenge. And so it's kind of was set up for failure on that front, to be honest. But we are committed to getting this into compliance with what is defensible relative to these hatchery fish spawning on the gravels and still maintain the support for the fishery that it provides. And so there is a very modest reduction in the hatchery production. So we're kind of throwing the kitchen sink at this one. We've got a slight reduction in the hatchery production while we sort through this. We're doing things to improve homing into the hatchery and giving them a chemical signature or cues that they can then imprint on. And then we're also, remember the straying is you've got a, your numerator, you know, is the number of hatchery fish over the total number of spawners, and so we want to ensure that the wild fish numbers are going up because that's going to help you with your stray rates. And so there's a huge focus on habitat work as well as reducing wild fish harvest so that more can escape to the spawning grounds, and focusing harvest on the hatchery fish, and improving estuarine and upland habitat. And this is a remarkable program in that you've got local landowners, watershed councils, fish, both sport and commercial fishing interests, working with the folks, the district down there, to really get this from a red to a green. We're committed to this as one of our primary priority areas, along with the Nestucca and Nakanakim, and pretty excited about this. No results to share with you yet. We're still in the infancy of that. And this approach is the way we're going to be approaching the full coast. Obviously, our resources are limited, but we're going to be taking these priority actions where, particularly where things are at risk. So outcomes. Portfolio of hatchery and wild fish emphasis areas, sliding scale harvest, a habitat emphasis. We've got over 3.5 million committed to monitoring so that we can gauge our success and move forward. Best management practices for our hatcheries, a very good linkage to the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. In fact, the work down on imprinting on Elk River Hatchery is fully folded in to the Hatchery Research Center activities. And then, remarkably, we came out of this with a high level of public and political support with its adoption. And we hope to maintain that as we implement. But we welcome the opportunity to check in with you on regular intervals. So,
thank you. Representative McEwen?
Chair Witt, thank you. And thank you so much for being here to update us on this. This was a long, ongoing process, and it's really nice to kind of see the culmination of how all that work has come together. This may be an off-the-wall question, but if you were king of the world on the Elk River, is that hatchery just in the wrong place?
Yeah.
So
and if we had unlimited resources, what would you do about it?
Well, Chair Witt, at Representative McCune, in hindsight, I'd probably cite it differently, and I'd certainly give it a unique signature as far as water supply if I could. But that hatchery was actually sited there under the assumption that you could fully integrate hatchery and wild fish production into a seamless unity, and you didn't have to worry about differences or impacts. And so it used all wild brood stock. And so its intent was noble. We have found since then that that's probably not the best way to go. And so, but it is what it is. And I think that we are very capable. I mean, time will tell. But I think we can still have a strong hatchery program there with the conservation responsibilities being met if we're diligent.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Please.
Yeah, we'll look forward to an update on this. I know this is a work in progress, and it's, you know, something we all kind of have our eye on. But we'll look forward to seeing how the Hatchery Research Center work impacts this particular hatchery. So we'll look forward to having you back.
Thank you. I did want to just brief update on coastal coho, if I may, Chair Witt. The federal recovery plan is out in draft form with comments open through early December. We are coordinating that for the executive branch relative to that. With a real eye on using this as a pathway towards another run at delisting. The state of Oregon has had two failed attempts at that already under my tenure, losing in court both times, and we feel we still have a very strong argument that is strengthened by additional 10 years of implementation of the Oregon plan. Timing right now, we're heading into a very sour time in the ocean. As you've heard, the conditions are not very good for salmon out there right now. And if that persists, similar to what we had in the 90s, if these coho come out of that robustly like they did in the late 90s, that will be helpful for our argument. If they don't come out of it well, then as a state, we probably want to reconsider our view on coho and their ability to be resilient during these downturns. Coho will decline. They do. When the ocean goes south, coho crash. But they tend to flourish as they come out the backside of that. And so we'll be tracking that very carefully. Okay?
I have a question.
Very good. Vice Chair Krieger, question?
Well, more go back to Elk River because when I started, there was no hatchery. 64. I didn't come into it. I think 68 was actually a commercial fish hatchery started out by funded by them. And I think people need to understand that during average water years or low water years, there was a tremendous amount of main stem spawning below the hatchery. And our hatchery fishery actually getting hung up with those fish down there. And of course, those good years, as you said, they come up the hatchery, but there's the river and the hatchery have the same scent pattern. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was a lot of controversy. I had a lot of calls. Hey, what are you doing supporting a reduction in these hatchery fish? But it goes back to the same thing, Ed, that if the Salmon Research Center can find out what hatchery practices are causing hatchery fish to be less productive and get our hatchery fish to be more compatible with wild fish, a lot of the concerns over time could go away.
Yes.
But we're talking about, you know, we've got your funding. I think the chair helped. Everybody on this committee, I believe, helped.
Yes.
$1.2 million at the research center for the next 10 years. That's a lot of money. So guys like Remrick there and myself and a few others may not be around. especially, I know we're not going to be around here. But we're looking forward to seeing what the answers are, because if anything came out of some of this controversy of the conservation plan and everything was, and I talked to Tom back there and Jim Myron, the value of wild fish has been more recognized and the science behind their, you know, doing that. So if we want to value them and we want to protect them, one of the reasons, things you have to do, is make hatchery fish compatible and not negative to them on the spawning grounds.
Representative Woodson.
I was wondering what salmon, type of salmon, is it that's returning in record numbers up the Columbia to the dams? There was a big press release about a month ago that they had more salmon returning to the dams, the highest reaches of the dams, Bonneville's reporting, than any time since the dams were put in.
Chair Witt and Representative Witsit, although this year was a really bad year within the Columbia River because of the high water temperatures, that and we lost, I think it was about 50% of the sockeye that were returning. The runs coming into the river were very robust, and the Chinook weathered that storm much better, particularly those coming in the fall after temperatures moderated a little bit. And so I think you're referring to the couple different groups of fish. One of them are the upriver bright fall Chinook that are primarily produced in the Hanford Reach, and those numbers were not record. The actual were less than last year, but it was very good still, in the hundreds of thousands. But we also had a very good return for some of the new kind of just beginning programs that we've put in place in the upper Columbia relative to the Colville tribes. And so there's some of the fish actually began returning to some of those. And those are new programs trying to get fish up to below, you know, all the way up to Cooley, actually. And many of those tribes are looking into actually trying to restore some of their tribal fisheries. And that's probably the media piece that you heard about, because it's a very new program.
It was the Hanford, actually.
It was the Hanford.
They said they had not, the account I read said they had not had numbers like that since the dams were put in. So
yeah, the last couple years have definitely been, and the Hanford Reach fish have been doing quite well. And those, of course, are affected by the four dams on the lower Columbia, you know, and the spawning is in that Hanford Reach. But we also have hatchery programs of those. They're called Upriver Brights.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Hey, now for the real star. Well,
I hope I can find this. Is it
Tom? Welcome.
Right behind them. I'm sure you're gonna get it.
Good deal.
Chair Witt, committee members, my name is Tom Rumreich. I'm a step biologist from Coos Bay. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. A number of years ago, some friends of mine on a Wednesday heard the announcement that the then director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Jack Donaldson, was going to adopt a public involvement program. Hadn't quite been named yet, the Salmon Trout Enhancement Program, but was patterned very similar after the British Columbian programs. 3 days after that announcement, my friends and I, we were out stomping around South Slough up Winchester Creek, and we identified a stream that was devoid of coho. And on that day, we developed a restoration plans. So the interesting thing I love about this photograph is when you see the people there of all different walks of life, all different ages, and both commercial and recreational fishers working together for the commonality of restoring coho in that little creek. And the exciting thing is that some of those members that you see there are actually will be volunteers tomorrow at Morgan Creek Hatchery. So it's exciting to see that legacy. We were successful in establishing a population of coho because that particular stream had a limitation, had a bottleneck, and the bottleneck is that it lacked spawning habitat, gravel. And subsequently, we put a single generation of coho into that stream. We addressed that limitation of spawning habitat, and to this day, it still has coho in it. When the program began, many of you who may be familiar with it, certainly Representative Krieger, it was deemed as a panacea to really address the limitation of coho, particularly and to some cases Chinook throughout the coast. And instead of a chicken in every pot, it was a hatchbox in everybody's backyard. And oftentimes people really wanted round little red things and they didn't really care where they came from. And unfortunately, as a budding biologist, had a low day. And this was one of the high days when I was able to look at and see the excitement and the potential of being able to do something positive for resources. And it was exciting to see and be a part of that. However, there was a day that I call Black Thursday. It wasn't the day that the stock market crashed. It was the day back in 1981 when 1 million Rogue River coho were transferred to a plethora of hatchboxes throughout the Coquille River watershed. Unfortunately, my knowledge of that life history of Rogue River coho is that these eggs and these fish were going to be counterproductive rather than really enhancing the population of coho within the Coquille River Basin. There are opportunities for hatchboxes, and we have found several of them throughout the history of the use of them throughout Coos County. And one example is Fall Creek up on the South Fork Coos River. It had a series of waterfalls that was completely impassable. The legacy of this project is when the road was first put in 1958, there were literally generations of people rolling rocks down in the canyon trying to get and obtain fish passage at this falls, and subsequently they recognized the value of the production above this falls as we did in 1982 when we started releasing hatchbox fry above it, and we continued to do that into 1997. The landowner was basically did not want to relinquish control and give us the opportunity to provide fish passage, didn't want anadromous fish up in that forested area. So in 1997, we started the construction of our Fall Creek Fishway with the goal of trying to provide access for those hatchbox fry. There were no naturally occurring salmonids above that fall, so we didn't have any concerns there. We did were able to create fish passages there to access 9 miles of habitat for those hatchbox fry that were residing in that area, and we still have established populations today. The Fall Creek Fishway has been a success story for hatchbox fry. We saw good seeding levels, but again, it was a limited example of being able to utilize habitat and address a limitation and not have any type of conservation concerns relative to any naturally occurring salmonids. There are, what we've seen in Coos County, we've evolved. We've evolved to the point where we're not able to really utilize the tool of hatchboxes in a great many different streams, but we've evolved from the standpoint of utilizing them as a program as a whole. Representative Krieger, we were blessed to have him at our dedication of our Morgan Creek facility 2 weeks ago, where we have constructed a very large incubation and rearing facility, really rearing station. What we've done is we've shifted from unfed fry releases to releasing fish as pre-smolts. And the premise of this began a while ago. And it started back in 1987 when they first started systematically running logs down through a process called splash dams down the river. The then logging companies had an objective. They wanted to make those rivers a sluice box. And they didn't want their logs hung up. So they, in one case, in one example on the South Fork Coos River, dynamited 4,000 logs, root rods, and boulders out of the channel to make sure their logs went down the channel very successfully. Unfortunately, that was incredibly degrading to the habitat. I've been blessed to be on the district for almost 40 years, and as I began my career, the biologists that were just leaving had a snapshot of 40 years before I got there, and they virtually said that you could go up a river like the West Fork of the Millicoma and not find a 5-gallon bucket of gravel. Subsequently, the splash dams removed, destroyed the gravel. With that limitation of spawning habitat and the balance of the largest estuary in Oregon, a 10,000-acre underutilized rearing niche, that's where our program began, and that's the basis of it today. In 2015, we marked 2.1 million fall Chinook fish that may have formerly been released as unfed fry that we are now rearing to pre-smolts, and we have had a huge opportunity to incorporate vast members of our community in this operation. The purpose of our marking is unequivocally monitoring and evaluation, and the opportunity to go ahead and to to get people involved, to evaluate from certainly conservation concerns, evaluate our string, evaluate our harvest, and certainly have that educational connection, which is invaluable to creating the stewards of the future. We just recently constructed a 5-year coos monitoration and monitoring and evaluation study where we were able to really look at our program and seeing definitively through the best science available to us what we were able to do. This is our operation of our Delwood trap at the head of Coos River, where we marked numbers of fish, up to 2,000 fish annually, in an effort to try to do a Peterson mark recapture population estimate and really not only quantify the number of fish that were in that basin, but particularly the hatchery fraction or the stray rate. And we were very pleased with our results. Certainly, the other component of that is the hatchery harvest. And we were able to, during that 5-year period, conduct statistical creels that determined that of the fish that were being currently harvested within the basin, about 80% or more of those fish were a product of our programs. So we were able to, again, address that limitation through spawning habitat, not only by going out and doing the habitat work, but concurrently releasing large numbers of pre-smolts or fingerling fall chinook to utilize that vacant rearing niche within the estuary. We are very proud today of the connection that we've made with the community, not only from an educational standpoint, but virtually all community members seem to be involved in our program, from virtually kindergartner through whatever age. And I wish you all could see the SWOC basketball boys team that will be sorting fish at our Morgan Creek fish hatchery on Thursday this week. It is nothing short of amazing to see inner city kids that have never seen anything larger than a goldfish fall chinook salmon. So anyway, that's all I had.
Thank you very, very much. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And Tom, thank you so much for being here. I have to take this opportunity to sing your praises a bit. I've known Tom for quite some time, and I want to apologize for not being at the dedication the other day. Senator Roblin and I drew straws, and I ended up out at Lighthouse Way trying to figure out how to keep a house from landing on the beach, and should it land on the beach, how we would clean that up. So I was very disappointed to not be able to be there. Tom, how many students' desks have had salmon on them in the Coos Bay North Bend School District in the last 10 or 15 years?
100,000, something along those lines. And that we take great pride, and practically every single student in Coos County has their own living, breathing Chinook egg at their desk to poke and name, and then subsequently rear in their aquarium in their school. And that starts the connection from K through 4th, and then as 5th graders, it's the rite of passage, and I wish you could all be there at our facilities this week. You would, however, need hearing protection because OSHA is talking about condemning us because of decibel levels are too high with screaming fifth graders. But it is that connection. It really, truly is an exciting component of being able to utilize all members of our society and in achieving, hopefully, again, that commonality of more fish.
And follow up, sir, I just don't want to lose sight of what a model has been created in this estuary by this gentleman right here who is now a short timer. And you will be sorely missed in my community when you do walk out the door soon as a retiree, a newly minted retiree. But what you've created on the educational side of things as a former school board member, someone who's been in those classrooms and seen those children with those fish on their desks and seen them up at the hatchery clipping fins and wrestling fish, and what they take away from that is just priceless. It truly is priceless. And the children in our community are so... they're so fortunate to have the opportunities that they have because of the work that you did, Mr. Rumreich.
And well, thank you.
I just want to make sure that is acknowledged. He's also done great work with our food banks, making sure that high-quality protein that comes back to the hatchery when it's still in good shape is distributed out to our local food banks, and that people have an opportunity to experience, you know, high-quality food that doesn't normally get to food banks. You've done great work on a lot of fronts, not only the science side, but the social side and the educational side of what can be done when you're dedicated and you do great work. And I, for one, thank you very much for everything that you've done for my community.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Krieger.
His wife's not bad either. Thank you for being here, Julie.
I guess kind of to both of you, you know, you got here long after he'd started his program. He learned what he was doing. And as Caddy said, everybody in Coos County, not everybody, but most kids at some time were touched by his program. And I think that's a great thing for the PR for the department. And I'm going to read you a couple things from statute and I have, and I ask you a couple questions. You love it when I talk about statutes. And it's 496, 458. It says the State Department of Fish and Wildlife shall, not can, may, it says shall, that's a direction, develop and implement a remote hatch box program. They identify sites and tributaries that are suitable for remote hatch boxes, adopt rules, report annual to the legislature. I haven't known you guys to come and talk annually about hatch boxes since I've been here. Then it says over on, let's see, where are we at? 496, 440, I believe is where it is. The department should provide appropriate State Department of Fish and Wildlife personnel to act as community advisors, provide technical assistance, coordinate and implement enhancement project, provide educational informational, develop and implement the remote hatch box program as described. And what I want to know, Ed, is this particular creek, Morgan Creek, and what happened there. It would seem to me that there are probably other places that would lend themselves, maybe not to that degree because you don't have as big an estuary down below, but, you know, originally we had hatch boxes in the Winchuck, Chetco, Coquille, and even Euchre Creek, where I am. Things took place, and all that kind of went away. So can you tell us how many hatch box programs you got other than the Morgan Creek thing? And why we aren't taking the opportunity to follow the statute, which is directive. It says shall, doesn't say you can if you get around to it. And then add on to that, now with the Salmon Research Center and having a geneticist there, the old argument, well, we can't tell if they're marked, we can't tell if anything's coming back, we don't know if we're getting any production, we now can profile the mother and father, use wild eggs in hatch boxes, which are now dumped, some of the wild, and actually give people an opportunity to participate and be partners with you. I think it's one of the biggest PR things that you could do. Now, that's a lot of what I've said, but you kind of wrap that up for
me. Yeah, and Chair Witt and Representative Krieger, I think you raise a very important question. The genesis of the STEP program, or the kind of nugget of it, was certainly hatch boxes back in the early 80s. The statutes, as you said, were fairly clear. Let me start by saying that STEP, the Salmon Trout Enhancement Program, is not in decline and is actually, I believe, growing. The use of hatch boxes as a tool to enhance fisheries, to recover stocks, and to connect people with fish has diminished. But in enhancing fisheries, conserving stocks, rebuilding stocks, and connecting people with fish has not declined. In fact, we're using different pathways to that. And the statutes are clear that the use of hatch boxes need to be consistent with our conservation responsibilities and using the best available science.
And be consistent with the Oregon plan.
Correct. And you brought up one issue with hatch boxes, and that's the inability to provide an external mark. And any mark that we do to those, there is an approach called where you can code the otolith through a temperature check. But a recovery and learning from that is very expensive. We are now getting better information, as Representative Krieger implied, through genetic work. We are not yet to the point, I would love it if we could, where you had a little litmus strip where you could just put it on the slime of the fish and it would tell you its heritage. We're not there yet. And so genetic follow-up of evaluating where this fish came from and would be very expensive and have to be absorbed within the program, which would take a hit on other important aspects. But perhaps more importantly than that is the fact that the tool of hatch boxes to contribute towards fisheries has proven really to not be effective. And the reason for that is because you are putting fish into a watershed that is limited by its habitat capacities. And so you have a bottleneck. So no matter how many fry you put into that, you're still going to come out at the end of it with the same number of smolts, and the data that has been evaluated demonstrate that if you have a lot of hatch boxes or don't, same number of smolts tend to come out. Now, in the Coos system, and Tom could certainly speak to this far more eloquently than I can, by jumping over that freshwater limitation and going to a pre-smolt situation, they're able to take advantage of the bounty of the estuary, this kind of fresh brackish water transition, use that capacity, and so they're keeping the fish in our custody, you know, through fish culture until they're ready for that estuarine sort of period, and then they've been able to really turn that into a remarkable fishery. One of the things Tom didn't mention is that while he's been doing that, he's been doing just as much work trying to reverse these legacy effects through these same volunteer armies of restoring. This is tough work. You're down to bedrock, you know, in many of these systems, scoured out, trying to recruit gravel, trying to reestablish the complexity of these channels. And, you know, wild fish have returned to the Coos system, coho and chinook and steelhead. And through our evaluations, we're able to demonstrate that his efforts to provide these hatchery fish for fisheries by getting them ready for the estuary, returning as adults, he's done that through his partnerships in a way that also is meeting our conservation responsibilities. Hatch boxes would not be able to do that because you'd be putting these hatchery fry into that same limited tributary watershed, which is going to come at the expense of the wild fish, whatever comes out to the estuary. Case by case, you bring up Representative Krieger, should we be doing this case by case? Yes. If we remove a barrier, whether it be, you know, removing dams on Evans Creek and the Rogue, do we want to jumpstart those through an egg injection program? Perhaps. Catching slough of the coos right now. We're actually in a study that we're doing right now doing just that, which is now going to have the adults starting to come back where they did egg injection. So I think there is an appropriate role for that, but the model that Tom has nurtured over the last several decades has been perhaps hatch boxes isn't the right tool to enhance fisheries, connect people with fish fully, and to meet our conservation responsibilities. But the STEP program definitely is, and hatch boxes are just one piece of that. And I'd commit to you, Representative Krieger, that we can replicate that model throughout the state robustly, and we are. If you look at the North Coast and the Mid Coast relative to volunteer programs working on habitat, North Coast on hatcheries, it is a very robust model, similarly. And I would say using the STEP program to get at those outcomes is what we should focus on, with hatch boxes being an important piece of that as appropriate. And Tom, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but you're welcome to.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, exactly what Ed said, and that we do have to be always very careful. Hatchboxes can be used as a tool. There are several cases and examples where we have been able to successfully establish populations of fish, but they also have to be used with caution. And just to put hatchbox fry over the top and potentially supersede naturally produced fish is really not prudent in many, many instances.
Got one follow-up.
Sure.
Of the fish that are going to Morgan Creek, they're in that whole Coos Bay area. Do you know if any of those are going up some of these other streams as strays, and that is part of the fish that you see now restored in some of those watersheds like the Coos River itself?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we do see some of our hatchery fish stray, and that was part of our five-year monitoring evaluation study. The average stray rate, though, was the hatchery fraction, if you will, up on the spawning grounds was on average about 8% over the course of our five-year study. And so, therefore, to answer your question, yes, some of those fish that we are seeing up there are hatchery fish. However, as Ed said, is that we have been very active since 1984 to aggressively address that limitation with spawning habitat, because the architect, if you will, of our whole program was my former program leader with the Coastal Falchionik Ecology Project, Al McGee, who said, if you have a single population of salmon to enhance in Oregon, you would unequivocally choose Coos River Falchionik because they have the greatest potential for increase. And he outlined the idea and the concept of pre-smolts. However, he also warned that by doing pre-smolts, it was nothing more than a Band-Aid, quote-unquote, because you really needed to go ahead and address that limitation of habitat, which we have done aggressively concurrently for years. However, it's very, very expensive. If we could go back and get back the 4,000 old-growth trees, root wads, and boulders that were dynamited out of the South Coos to make that an effective sluice box for running logs down it, that would cost literally billions and billions of dollars to replace that.
Representative Esquivel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say the genetic part of it is too expensive, what does that mean?
Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel, this is just the cost of doing the sort of assays.
How much is it is what I'm asking.
Oh, so it, the cost is going down, but you're talking tens of dollars per fish right now. So you can get assays done about $23 per fish to get these full pedigree work done. But things are improving on this front, and we are hopeful getting our geneticist and getting the lab, if we could do these in-house, this tool is going to be far better, I think, for us. But I don't think it'll ever get to the point where you're dealing with, for example, how many fish have returned to the Coos system this fall?
30,000, 25,000 to 30,000.
And so it would just take a big bite out of fish management if you were having to screen all of those through that approach. Taking subsamples, things like that, definitely options where we don't have to check all of them.
Please.
I think that we would probably behoove us to look into purchase of the particular machinery to do so. Okay.
Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel, part of what was afforded through both a budget note and then through our base budget was a startup for a state geneticist, $200,000 for this biennium of general fund. We really appreciate that. And that's in partnership with Oregon State University. And right now, They're having some struggles getting the equivalent, the position. But we, a portion of that, to the tune of $100,000 of that for this biennium, was geared towards the service and supplies and equipment. We are definitely looking at that. And right now we're canvassing internally what is all our genetic works that we are outsourcing right now, so that we can get a clear picture of how much of this can we bring back home and have savings as well as control of that?
Well, please. What I'm seeing and thinking about in the future is that we don't have to clip fins in the future. if we use genetics.
Chair Witt and Representative Escoval.
Because that, to me, is very cumbersome and time-consuming.
It is, and obviously it's... I don't see that as in the immediate future until we get to that perhaps miracle litmus paper test, because certain times, you know, we're blessed on the coast where we can actually retain wild fish. Many of our fisheries are marked selective for hatchery fish, and then there was a period in the mid to late last decade where we had a downturn in ocean, and we actually had a marked selective fishery on the Coos system where it was a bonus fish because we had to have less wild fish retained, and yet they were able to keep those hatchery fish, so it really helped the local economy. And I would not want to lose that opportunity for fishers to actually have a marked selective fishery if they needed to. And obviously for steelhead and coho, you know, it's marked selective.
Final.
Yes.
Then please explain to me, when you were talking about you have these extra fish in these boxes, why the same number goes out no matter what you put in the box. I don't understand that. Because if I put a million small fish in the stream that I'd done out of a hatchery, and if 95% of them died, that'd still be 50,000 coming back, wouldn't it?
So Chair Witt and Representative Escoval, so on the marking and the detection, we're talking about the adults and the fact that in order for the fishermen to know what's a hatchery fish so we can keep them, they have to be visually a hatchery fish, okay? So that's the external mark, the adipose clip. Regarding the bottlenecks, when you have a set capacity for a system that's constrained either by spawning or rearing, then the system is only going to, just like a pasture, you know, with a cattle herd, you're only going to produce so many head from that. And so it can be a mix of hatchery and wild. It can be all wild or it can be all hatchery, but it's still only going to put out that same group of animals or fish. And that's all I was saying, is that by putting those hatchery fish on top of those wild fish, you're going to often displace some of those wild fish, which then brings in a constraint to our hatchery programs because we're not meeting our conservation responsibilities. And we would rather not have those constraints on our hatchery programs. Allow those to flourish where we can meet our conservation responsibilities and have our hatchery programs like Tom's done with this pre-smolt release. Fry, you wouldn't be able to do that, plus the numbers. Tom he's a lot better at explaining this perhaps than me, so if that didn't resonate, he can do that now, or we can come around and chat with you about that.
Well, go ahead. You need to come and visit with me.
Okay.
Because
I may not have Tom with me, though.
So. I don't care.
Okay.
Hey, I'm going to have to cut off the questions after Rep. McEwen and Vice Chair McLean. If you can ask your question, can you ask it of the next panel? Will that work?
This will be really quick.
Okay.
I just wanted to touch with Mr. Bowles on what the challenge is in hiring a geneticist. You said you're having some difficulty there. Why is that? And I wanted to touch on one issue here. Fin clipping doesn't necessarily have to be cumbersome. I understand there's a trailer out there that comes in, and you can clip large numbers of fish very quickly. Am I correct?
Correct.
Yes. As long as the trailer's available. But what's the challenge on hiring a geneticist?
And Chair Witt and Representative McEwen, I can follow up with you.
Okay, that would be fine.
Like,
we can do that offline.
Representative Krieger and I chatted this morning, so if you'd want to, I can follow up. But it's basically we have the money for we don't have position authority right now. That was going to come from Oregon State University, but we don't have that now.
Okay, thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Mine is come and talk to me. I just want to talk about temperature, because no matter if you're a wild fish or you're a hatchery fish, it seems to me like the water temperature and you're moving fish in the summer, and it looks like we have 20 years of decreasing, you know, snowpack. And so if that's the case, it seems like there's a lot of more important things to do to keep any fish alive. And so I just want to talk about where we are in that study and in that discussion.
Chair Witt and Representative McLean, I'll be happy to do that, and that's very much on our mind right now, particularly with last year's situation. So.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much, and I certainly appreciate your patience with all of our questions, but you were very succinct and to the point, and for that I thank you very much for the information you provided us.
Thank you. Thank you.
With that, I'm going to call forward a panel of four people this time. Joe Rollator, Tom Wolf, Jim Smith, and Representative Wilson. And if we could, we already have a fourth chair coming up.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to know that we must be very quick here because Tom has to go fishing in Eastern Oregon. So,
yes.
And he's chomping at the bit.
No,
I really didn't want you to share
that. You know, I don't know about your high school representative, but in mine, when it was deer season,
it was gone.
It was empty, and it was almost like it was a contest. The principal would jump around, jump up and down. He was up on the ceiling half the time, screaming and yelling that people could not be cutting class or school to go hunting. And then we'd have a contest to see whose parents, supposedly parents, wrote the best permission slip for the absence. And we have someone with us today who very straightforward said, "I need to go fishing. Can I have permission to be excused?" So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Today is the last day of the first elk season, and it's about an hour left.
Uh-huh.
And you see where I'm sitting.
Well, no mercy. No mercy.
I'm not getting a lot of love.
No mercy.
You aren't getting much sympathy, Tom.
No mercy. No backstrap.
Well, Chair Witt, Joe gave me permission to go first, so I will. Committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the chair, executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We're very heavily involved in the coastal management multi-species plan. Of course, we're a wild fish group, so therefore we work very hard on trying to make sure that wild fish populations were protected. And of course, we didn't get everything that we wanted in the plan, but I have to be honest, ODFW and the other groups worked very hard, and as you could see from the map that Ed showed, there were a lot of wild fish emphasis up there, so it actually turned out very well for us. So in follow-up with that, we're working in two different areas. We have two different programs going on. One is called the Salmon Superhighway, which is a multi-stakeholder group working in the Tillamook, Nehalem, Nestucca area, where we're working with private landowners, ODFW, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the National Forest Service, to look at ways that we can improve habitat so that we can increase the number of wild salmon and wild steelhead in those systems. And it's been a very good program working with a lot of people that don't always work well together, you know, the feds, private landowners, and we've kind of been, through our staff personnel and more, we've been the lead in making sure that everybody's been able to talk with and work with each other, and we're kind of building off this ODFW multi-species plan as our kind of our blueprint of where we're going to go with this, how we're going to get people to work with, because one of the things in our group is, you know, and I always hear a lot of stories about conservation groups suing, and that's true. They do that. But we at Trout Unlimited try as little as possible to be litigious. Not that we haven't been once or twice in our 50-year career, but we try to, an emphasis we really have is to work with partnerships with local stakeholders, with everybody, because we're all Oregonians. We're all working to recover fish. We may be pro-hatchery. We may be pro-wild. But we need to work together. And ODFW has given us a blueprint. We're working hard within the Salmon Superhighway. The second thing is what we call the Wild Steelhead Initiative. It's a West Coast TU program that started last fall right after the plan was unveiled, but we're working very hard with that plan to look at ways to protect and enhance wild steelhead, because wild steelhead is considered the number one freshwater game fish in the United States. And I'm sorry to any smallmouth bass people out there, but steelhead are number one. Sorry. This is the program working, again, building partnerships, not trying to get in a fight with the pro-hatchery people, not trying to say we can't use hatcheries, because we can. Hatcheries will always be part of it. But look at ways that we can recover our steelhead using the blueprint in Oregon that ODFW has given us with this multi-species plan, and look at a way that we as wild fish people can work with local landowners, recreational fishing groups, the commercial industry, and everybody to build partnerships. So right now we're still in the Wild Steelhead Initiative working on how exactly we do that, how do we work on the coast, and we're still in the planning stage. But that's kind of our follow-up to the ODFW multi-species plan, is what we're doing to work. Now that the plan's going, how do we make it work? And that's what Trout Unlimited's doing. And I don't always, over the last 25 years, I haven't always agreed with everything that ODFW's done, and Ed Bowles will tell you that, but this is a good plan, and it's a good start, and we appreciate all the work ODFW has done in creating this blueprint that will restore salmon and steelhead and trout on the coast. Thank you.
Tom, thank you very, very much. And I want to thank you for the approach that you take, you've always taken, and you allow and provide for other people's interests, and that your own interests don't preclude someone else having an interest in hatchery production and those sorts of things. And I think if we had more people take that approach, we'd have a lot more agreement on fixing some of the problems that we face. So I thank you for that very much. Who's next?
I'll be happy to.
Representative Wilson, great to see you again. Welcome to our committee.
Chair Witt, great to see you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Members of the committee, you've been very patient today. And thank you. I want to take just a moment to speak in reference to one of my constituents, Jim Smith, who is here today. He'll introduce himself. I am Carl Wilson, House District 3 State Representative. I want to give you perhaps a Southern Oregon picture of the Hatchbox program. Our perspective in Southern Oregon is somewhat different many times than in other parts of the world. I know nothing about fishing. I do not fish. I probably will never fish. But the individual that I'm going to introduce today knows all about the Rogue River because he has grown up in Grants Pass. He's been on the river his entire life. I, as a member of the media, have been watching my community for years, and I can tell you that for many years people came from the world over to fish the Rogue River in the Grants Pass area. Some very famous people did so. They don't do that anymore. They haven't for years. No matter how many dams we seem to tear out, nothing ever improves. And that's disturbing because, as sort of an amateur historian in my district, I've seen black and whites taken years ago, some of the most amazing strings of fish I have ever seen. We haven't seen that in years, and we don't seem to be getting any closer to that. So we're looking for answers in our area. We're looking for things that actually do work, things that can make a measurable difference. As all of you know, our part of the world is extremely depressed financially. Mm. We've been very slow to come back. We look for anything that can enhance the economy of our region. Better fish runs would certainly do that. So again, thank you for your patience. I appreciate you bringing us on today. And without further ado, I would like to introduce a good friend of mine for my whole life, Mr. Jim Smith. Jim.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Welcome.
Chairman Witt, Vice Chairman Krieger, and ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate this opportunity to speak to you and with you. It's heartening to see what is reported from the coast. What you heard in the presentation preceding ours was exactly what we yearn for on the Rogue River system. I say system because the Rogue River is a part of also the Illinois River and the Applegate River. It is incredibly important to at least three counties, Curry, Josephine, and Jackson. Incredibly important, the fishery to Grants Pass, Medford area. And as Carl points out, we really need every economic boost that we can possibly get in our community. We've gone from, I guess I should say we're lucky that we went from timber and lumber to retirement. And I would like to see those people who retire have the opportunity that I had on the Rogue River. The river is a living entity. If you think of it on a map, the drainage that you see on our streams, what does that remind you of? When I look at it, it reminds me very much of the physical vascular system. Our situation on the Rogue River is one where we are dependent on Lost Creek Dam, for all of the fish enhancement that takes place on that river. Which is to say that we are minimized and in most cases totally nullifying the tributary streams as reproductive areas for salmon and steelhead. Most of the information that I'll share with you is not scientific. I want you to know that. And I want to ease any apprehension by assuring you that I ask you for not one copper penny. The program that I'll explain would have the community paying for the hatch boxes, volunteer labor, the gas in the trucks to get those hatch boxes placed, so there would be no state cost associated with the program on the Rogue River. I inherited a river as a youth with abundance. I'm embarrassed to say today that what I pass on to my grandchildren is not abundance. We've had some elements that have interfered with abundance. We have to consider that we have the highest technical commercial fishing going on 12 miles beyond our shores than anyone could ever imagine. Tremendous takes in commercial fish. We have on the Rogue River uncontrolled packs of sea lions in Gold Beach that do no good to any of those fish. You might think that, well, that's what they need to eat on. No, if you'll watch a pack of sea lions, they kill for the killing. And then we add in the problem of squawfish upstream, and who knows the hundreds of thousands of smolt and fry that are eaten annually by squawfish. So the people that I'm talking about, in my empirical sense, were worried about the same thing that we worry about. They were worried because they were commercially harvesting tons of fish. It started in the late 1800s in Gold Beach, and the man that started the fish processing plant in Gold Beach very quickly, within 2 years, opened a hatchery on Indian Creek. And so it was on upstream as commercial fishermen took fish from the river. They had concerns, knowing that they were migratory. They had concerns for depletion of the very thing that could mean their salary the next year. What did they do? They created hatcheries, and they put hatch barrels up the tributary streams. Uniquely in the Grants Pass area, they found out that they could put their hatch barrels up there, and they didn't have to risk their lives pulling nets in the river in waterlogged dories, they could use pitchforks in the tributary streams to harvest their fish. Now I come on the scene because I think I enjoyed the abundance of the River of the Stars. That's what the Rogue River was referred to. Carl had reference to it also. The fact of the matter is that we don't have that abundance today. What do we want? What do we need? We need fish production in our tributary streams with the use of hatch boxes. That's one system. Or if the ODF&W would insist on no hatch boxes, we would like them to use the smolt that they produce in their pools and ponds at Lost Creek Dam and to bring them to those tributary streams and imprint them so the fish would go back to the tributary stream as opposed to directly to the spillway of the dam where they've been placed. Right now, I think it's criminal that the guiding service in Grants Pass, when patrons go to their website or call them on the phone, I think it is absolutely disgusting that for much of the year, they're taking their patrons to the Coos, the Coquille, and the Umpqua. Why? Because the fish that return to the Rogue River are predominantly Lost Creek Dam fish, and they want to get to that dam as soon as possible. Hence, the fishing in the middle section of the Rogue River is pitiful by comparison with when I was a youth and a young adult. Sorry, I got beyond myself here. These issues have been brought up by numerous people to the attention of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I plead my case with you by explaining that the explanation that we've received from the department, as it involves the Rogue River, is that we really want this to be a wild river. Now think what I've talked to you about. They are putting in, at the dam, 350,000 smolt raised in ponds, and yet they're trying to argue to us that they want to keep the Rogue River a wild river. Doesn't make much sense. When you argue them down on that issue, what is their response? The response is, we're not certain there's enough bioplankton in the ocean to sustain any more anadromous fish. Worrisome. Worrisome when I see a presentation like preceded us, where people were actually doing the right thing and supposedly supported by the ODF&W in doing it. Now, one of two things must be the case. The ODF&W must really think that they want the Rogue River a wild river. Or maybe they're just doing bureaucratic foolishness with us. Or is it this? Is it this? Do we need to establish a Native American casino in Josephine County in order to gain a portion of that river back so that the casino is able to do whatever they want in the way of hatch boxes and hatchery enhancement? That's a conspiracy theory that goes around our little community because, you see, it appears that there are rules for people on the coast while an entirely different rule exists in southern Oregon on the Rogue River. I thank you for hearing my complaints. I wish I could be more positive, but so it goes.
Thank you very, very much. Mr. Smith, have you had an opportunity to sit down with some of the people from ODFW?
We had numerous meetings up until the 2009 legislation went into effect. I wish I could remember off the top of my head the Senate bill.
472
was the Senate bill. And up until that time, there were numerous conversations, numerous. The legislation that was passed called for Carberry Creek, which runs into Applegate Dam, is not a part of the river system. For Jackson Creek, which had an impediment by because of a road, and Evans Creek, because of two irrigation dams, to be hatchery box incubated and startups for experiment. The department got no response from anyone because there was no interest in dealing with a creek that ran into a lake or two creeks that had impediments that wouldn't allow an adequate return of fish. But conversation pretty much ended 5 years ago.
Okay. I'm going to call on Representative Esquivel.
I'm good right now.
And then Representative McEwen. But I am going to ask, and Representative Wilson, I'm sure that you'd be willing to host this meeting. I'm going to ask that the ODFW come to your office and meet with your constituent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. You're hearkening back to my childhood, Representative. My mother started fishing on the Rogue River in 1928. She raised us down there, my father and I did, since 1947, and we still have a home there. I remember the day when, as a family of five, we would go out through Powers, which was the only way to get to Agnes in those days, on a dirt road.
Where not too many people know Powers.
Where you could have 10 fish a day and 20 in possession. There were five of us. We'd take 100 fish out. And the game warden representative was right at the top of the hill above Powers as you went out of Illahee, and that's where you got checked by the game warden, because that's how you got in and out of there in those days. So
Krieger, a game warden?
Krieger's predecessor.
Probably Krieger.
But anyway, you're talking about things that are very near and dear to my heart and things that I've been involved in my entire life and that my family holds dear. But I'm very interested in having this conversation as well. And I would welcome participating in this in any way that I can. It's a fishery we all care about. In fact, I wrote a paper when I was in college when one of the dams was going in. I did research and wrote a paper on the dam that was going in upriver that we all had concerns about back in 1974. So anyway, if I can help in any way in bringing this conversation together, please call on me.
Representative McEwen, thank you very much, and Chairman Witt. If I could remark, the dams were controversial. I didn't mention in my statement that one of the most disgusting visions of my youth, fishing in a drift boat in August, and it happened numerous times, as a matter of fact, were smolt belly up in the backwaters with the sun shining off those bellies was like a mirror. There were tens of thousands of the smolt. And the reason? Low oxygenation and too warm a water. By golly, you know what solved that? Were the dams. We don't have that anymore. We have other impediments, but the smolt do survive now with the water quality that is given to us from the dam.
Representative McEwen, perhaps you'd like to join Representative Wilson during that meeting.
Happy to.
And any other committee members, as long as we do not have a quorum. Representative Esquivel, very quickly, please.
Mr. Smith, you fished there for quite a number of years. I first started fishing on the Rogue, I think I was 7 years old.
First time I ever went fishing.
It's become, I hear from so many people, it's become so complex to hunt, to fish on the Rogue River, that people have just thrown their hands up in the air and said, I'm not doing this anymore. We have a joke in Southern Oregon that you need to have a fishing pole in one hand and a tourney in the other in order to figure out how to fish. Now, we've made this very complicated because the state itself has kowtowed to small interest groups. What do you see on your part of the river? Because I'm up in the upper.
I would say quite the same, Representative Esquivel. To a degree of frustration that you can hardly imagine. It's disappointing because it doesn't have to be. If we use the empirical knowledge that was passed on to me by commercial fishermen who became fishing guides, we would have hatch boxes up those streams, we would have abundance, and we wouldn't have to worry about a fish that it is or is not fin clipped.
Thank you. Representative Vice Chair Krieger, please.
Just quick for Representative Esquivel. That was me, and I was in my early 40s at the time.
He probably wants to talk about 1929 when you were there as well.
I'm sure he's got to be careful because that gentleman and I are both 75.
Yes, we are. Representative McEwen, were you charged admission fees when you went through there or not? Don't answer that.
Hi.
So thank you all very, very much. And I'd like to move quickly to our good friend Joe Rollator. And Joe, if you can help us out here in just a couple of minutes, I'd be most appreciative.
I'm Joe Rollator. I live in Walport. I represent sports and commercial fishermen here, so you hear me a lot. I'm not going to say too much today, except I'm going to make a comment about when we were working on the multi-species plan and also when we were working on the fee increase last session, I noticed that there was really a lack of core support for ODF&W. And a month ago, I would have told you that the Hatchbox program was at least part of that, because I remember 30 years ago when I had a Hatchbox, I had five of them, it was fun. And we all had a lot of support for the department. We knew our biologists. We knew the fish truck driver. And so I think the one thing that I would say to this committee is I'd encourage you to find ways to get ODF&W to have more hands-on volunteer experiences, whether it's marking fish with or without a trailer, whether it's habitat work or whether it's hatch boxes. Those kinds of hands-on experiences bond people with the department. And these are very complicated issues. And you and I have spent many hours listening to the pros and cons and the scientists and the other people and the citizens like Mr. Smith. They're very complicated, but when you get down to the point where you know your biologist pretty well and you sit down and have a beer with them, you get a chance to talk about those issues.
Yes.
So I would just encourage you to have every opportunity to encourage ODF&W to work with outdoor education and to encourage hands-on volunteers.
Well, thank you, Joe. And I was going to save this for the good of the order at the very end of the meeting, but this is a great segue. And I want you to know that there were a number of us that that met today with the Sportsman's Caucus. And you'll know very well, because you've been at virtually every meeting, that the three different work groups that came out of this committee, one on predation, one on habitat, and one on financing for ODF&W, the Sportsman's Caucus has asked for the committee's work and for all of the recommendations going forward, so that they can begin their work in advocating for precisely the items that came out of that committee. And you and others will also remember that there was a bill that came out, two bills actually, in the legislature this last time, one on predation and one on kind of re-emphasis on what we need to be looking at. As a result of that, the Sportsman's Caucus is coming together bipartisan, bicameral, and will be advocating for those precise issues. So these are all of the work and all of the hours that we sat in all of those chairs, hopefully, is moving forward. And I have several of my colleagues here who were party to that today. And I am convinced that they are very serious about moving forward on that.
Thank you very much.
With that, gentlemen, thank you so much. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Coastal Multi-Species Conservation Plan and welcome and call forward our good friend Rich Angstrom to talk about the new mining association that has just been formed. Rich, great to see you. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
From fish to rocks.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Yes.
My name's Rich Angstrom. I am the legislative director, amongst other duties, for the New Oregon Mining Association. I would like to say Dave Honeycutt was going to join us, but he has a CLE, and he extends his apologies because he wanted some remarks also made. But I thought, first off, I would keep this brief, but talk about what is the OMA as far as how we've put it together. It is a nonprofit benefits organization. It's not going to be a member organization. And so we'll be funded through donations, much like Oregonians in Action and others. And it won't be like the Farm Bureau or Cattlemen or OCAPA that are more member-oriented. The board, we've been really fortunate. We picked up one of the best mining attorneys in the world, Frank Arisman, to be our chair, and he's stationed in Colorado. And Andy Bentz from Bentz Consulting, who's been working on the Calico mine, is our vice chair. Dave Honeycutt is our president of the organization. I'm the secretary, treasurer, and legislative director. And then we picked up Matt Ellsworth, who is from the American Exploration and Mining Association, the regional director out here. So that's the comprises our five board members. I think it's important to know, just to talk to you guys as we introduce the new organization and why the OMA was formed. It actually happened because Dave and I were working from two different perspectives trying to deal with mining outside of our perspective expertises in mine construction materials and his land use. And we were struggling with how to deal with the non-aggregate mining issues and then just the economic opportunities that are out there in Oregon for mining. And we did a series of tours around the state in Baker, and then we did one in, down on the south end of the state in Grants Pass, where we had an opportunity to visit with a number of miners, a number of ranchers, a number of state agencies and federal agencies, and other associations in the state as well as outside of the state about what was going on and what the opportunities were in the state. From my perspective, I was having a real hard time trying to figure out how to organize all of the miners in the state. As you know, they're kind of an independent crowd. And Dave was more focused on the side of what the economic opportunities are around the state for the various for the state, just from an economic development perspective. We put our heads together and realized the model of trying to handle it through different associations was not going to work, and that we needed to form a new association where miners that are working for hard rock mining and precious metals and basic materials had a voice in the Capitol. They've never had a voice before, and we thought it was important that when we stand up here, we had a clean hat that you guys can separate out and know who we were talking from, and not without the various things that come in from the other organizations. So with that, we put all of this together, and it was kind of a confluence of good ideas, and Dave and I have found that we're great partners working together, very much working with him. He's a very smart attorney. But it's once it's formed, it's what we're going to do with it that's important. So really my last kind of comments is where we're going to head with this. We're going to work on a bunch of projects. One of them is through the tours that we've been doing. We realize that both Southern Oregon and our Southeastern Oregon are really rich with material, copper, silver, zinc, chromium, talc, uranium, and rare earths. And just to name a few of the opportunities that we have around the state that are really kind of unexplored or have been explored but not mined or exploited at this point for economic opportunity. What Dave and I believe is what it'll do for those parts of the rural parts of the community is besides ranching and agriculture, it'll add the third wheel of the natural resource community, which is mining. And they are all family wage jobs. They're not minimum wage jobs. And some of them, as we've talked about, could bring hundreds of employees into those regions. And, you know, 100 employees in Portland is, you know, hardly a sniff. But you put that in Harney or Baker County, and that is a huge amount of employment opportunity. I think, just as an example, Ash Grove is around 116, 120, somewhere in that neighborhood as far as, you know, what it employs in Baker County. Just to kind of give you an idea how, and Ash Grove is a hugely important part of that economy. So, but with that, interesting, with the sage-grouse issue and what's just happened with the issues around sage-grouse, is Dave and I both feel that mining was kind of left out of that discussion, and it could, because it was one of the last things to do, is to kind of throw mining under the bus, as the way we kind of look at it. And by the way, we're not the only ones that looked at it that way. The American Exploration and Mining Association really felt that way, is that we need to engage now and try to figure out, you know, how we're going to deal with this new kind of ban on mining in those particular areas. The other things we're going to be working on is the placer mining issues. I think that's where I'm going to come in and do some lifting to try to coordinate that voice and represent those folks in the Capitol. As you know, they weren't coordinated and they were unrepresented and they didn't speak with one voice. I can tell you it's there's some opportunities there for all of that sector to have a strong voice in the Capitol that's consistent for you guys to rely on. We're going to be working on some legislation like we did last session with House Bill 3089, which kind of kicked it off, which went through this committee. And the one thing we were accomplished there for the first time, remember that was the big policy statement that Representative Bentz came in and did the presentation on. And then we consolidated all those mining bills to that one particular one. We, for the first time, declared mining a natural resource in Oregon. It was not declared in statute as such. And, of course, the other part of that is getting Dogami now focused on the opportunities and trying to – we're still struggling over the vision with Dogami. The industry strongly feels where Dogami needs to go is back to its roots of finding these resources and enticing other companies to come in and develop them for the economic growth and the employment growth opportunities. There's a little struggle, obviously, over that vision, but that's where we're going to be coming from on that one. And the last point is that I'd like to is we will be involved not only just the legislation, but we are going to be involved in litigation over mining-related issues. Dave and I are uniquely wear attorney hats. I'm a litigator, and he's also a litigator, and we're going to pick up some of the causes. And one of the things we're working on is we partnered with the Western Resources Legal Center. They've approved taking on the moratorium on the placer mining issue, and we're going to be pushing the state pretty hard on whether that's under basically the supremacy clause, not to get too wonky on you, but the supremacy clause and whether the state can preempt essentially federal law. We think not. And so we're working on that right now. And those are the kinds of things we're going to do. For all of you, if you have mining questions, get a hold of Dave or myself. We'll be responsive to the mining interests in the state. We are separating out our other issues from that so we have a clean voice for the mining community in Oregon. With that, Chair, that concludes my testimony, and thank you very much for the opportunity to introduce a new association to the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much for your presentation and introduction. Committee members?
Just to say, Mr. Chair,
yes.
The people he's talking about have not been represented. We get them in our office once in a while, some gold miner or something, and the federal government's been out threatening him. There's been more threats by the federal government on miners probably than anybody else, maybe ranchers right behind it. But
yeah.
The way they do business isn't good.
Representative Woodson.
Yes, I congratulate you on taking the challenge to court over Oregon's belief that it supersedes federal law with regards to mining. And I hope that the outcome, I hope you get it where it needs to go, and I hope the outcome is the way I think it will end up being. So.
We hope so, too. Yeah. Thank you.
And it sounds like you may have an opportunity to be working with some law students, perhaps, to give them a practicum and experience in litigation and that sort of thing.
Now, thank you for the question. One of the most fun things I've done this year was teach mining law at the WRLC, and specifically how the Supremacy Clause and the federal law and state law work around the mining law. You know, I get that much of the regulating community does not like the law that's still in effect, the Mining Act of 1877, but it's still the law of the land. And it was a fascinating, intellectually curious discussion that I had with the students. They pushed me back. I had pushed on them. It was quite an exchange of sitting there with a group of really, really smart students that are trying to understand natural resource law, mm-hmm. and to have conversation about the hierarchy between the federal government and the state government and the local government and how that works and whose laws supersede others, somebody else's laws. And it's pretty tough for the state to be telling the feds what to do on their own property. And if they allow mining on their own property, maybe the state ought to allow mining on the federal property.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, we've had numerous people in our offices over the years that have the problem with miners. And I've always told them to get organized or get an organization and a lobbyist. So I'm pleased to see that they're finally getting organized so they can be one voice instead of 15 voices out here or 30 voices.
Thank you.
And with that, Rich, thank you very, very much for that introduction. And we'll know who to send people to. We'll know who to go to now when we have these kinds of questions.
I know we'll have plenty of time to talk about
this. All right. Thank you very, very much. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the introduction of the new mining association. Committee members, anything for the good of the order?
Nope.
Anything more to be discussed? With that, we are adjourned. Committee members, thank you very, very much for your time. Committee members, thank you very, very much for your time. We are adjourned.